You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
You can't bail out the banks, leave the debts in place, and rescue the economy. It's a zero-sum game. Somebody has to lose, and that's what happened in 2009 when President Obama came in. He invited the bankers to the White House, and he said, "I'm the only guy standing between you and the mob with pitchforks." By what he meant, the voters that he was bamboozling, he assured the bankers, he said, "Look, my loyalty is to my campaign donors, not to the voters. Don't worry, my loyalty is with you."
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Rescuing the Banks Instead of the Economy. Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri-Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. His latest books are Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Destroy the Global Economy, and J is for Junk Economics. Today we discuss how the bank bailouts, not the crash, is killing the economy, the concept of debt deflation, the magic of compound interest, the growth of the financial extraction fire sector, quantitative easing, and tariffs, economic sanctions, and isolationism. Dr. Michael Hudson, welcome.
Well, it's good to be back after a few years.
Boy, I'll say. I've just read your article, The Lehman 10th Anniversary Spin as a Teachable Moment. Obviously, 2018 is the 10th anniversary of the 2008 stock market crash. You immediately point out that today's financial malaise is a result of the bank bailouts, not the crash. I think people might find this statement surprising, since the claim is that the bailout saved the economy.
Well, I think what all the newspapers said was the bailout saved the banks, and to the bankers, the banks are the economy. The fact is, you can't save the banks and the economy, because if you save the banks, then you're saving all of the debt that people owe to the banks. And if you save all of the debt that the people owe to the banks, and you foreclose on the 3 to 9 million families that forfeited their homes in the mortgage crisis, if you leave the debts growing at compound interest, raising the debt equity ratios and the debt income ratios, then the economy is going to shrink and shrink and shrink, and we're in a slow crash. So, in a sense, the celebration over, we saved the banks, was correct last week, but people don't realize that the economy cannot be saved unless there's a bank crash. And that's just exactly what Sheila Bair wrote in her autobiography. She was the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And she pointed out that Citigroup, was insolvent. It had lost all of its money on bad gambles. She said it was the worst managed bank in America, is distinct from the just plain crooked banks and criminal banks like Countrywide and Bank of America and Wells Fargo. And she said that there was plenty of left in Citibank, that all the insured depositors could have been reimbursed. No insured depositor would have lost money. But the stockholders and the bondholders that ran this this crooked gambling institution would have been wiped out. And she said that Obama and Geithner really represented Citibank. Geithner was a protege of Rubin, who was Secretary of the Treasury under President Clinton, and she said she found out, she was told, look, it's all about the bondholders. So the problem is that people who are discussing, you know, what happened 10 years ago, either they are Republican free enterprise bankers who said, well, nothing to see here, folks. Everything's fixed now. We don't have to do any regulation. Let the banks be free again. And you have the Democrats, like Paul Krugman. And the problem is that they are still, they cannot come to criticize what Obama did. And so you had a week ago, Paul Krugman, who is the main Democratic propagandist. He ceased to be an economist. He's just plain flack for the banks and for the donor class of the Democrats now, wrote that the Washington Beltway was just crazy to believe that America had a debt problem. And I wrote that in the article. Krugman said that all you need is Keynesian policy to run a large enough budget deficit that you'll spend money into the economy so that wage earners will have enough money to pay the banks all the money that they owe. And I think his position is the Democratic Party's position. The role of wage earners is to make enough money that all of their income over and above survival needs has to be paid for the banks. What he wrote was, let me quote what he wrote in September 14th in the Times. The purely financial aspect of the crisis was basically over by the summer of 2009. And we're still living in the roots of the financial crisis. The debt crisis is a financial crisis. And he criticized the common sense observation that most of your listeners, I'm sure, can realize right away, Beltway consensus, that despite high unemployment and record low interest rates, debt, not jobs, was the real problem. He says there's no debt problem. It's all just jobs, and if you pay people more, they can pay the banks. There's no feeling at all within the Democratic Party that somehow the banks should have been subordinate to saving the economy. And I think that is one of the major reasons why Hillary lost the 2016 election. She kept saying, aren't you better off today than you were 8 years ago when Mr. Obama was elected? Well, most people, especially in the Midwest, said, no, we're not off. Are you kidding? We've lost our homes. Employment's way down. Our wages are much lower. Our pension funds are being seized. Of course, we're not better. And more and more people stayed home. And there was just a survey I was reading today that I think 55 to 85% of Americans say if there was a rerun of the 2016 election between Trump and Hillary, they just wouldn't vote. Because they're both so bad. And so what you really have seen in this anniversary is not the discussion that you needed to have, which is how are we going to deal with the next crisis to avoid bailing out the banks all over again. If we don't bail out the banks, what's our policy? How are we going to take over the insolvent banks, take them public? And, you know, as Sheila Bair pointed out, if Citibank would have been taken over by the FDIC, it wouldn't have made crooked loans. It wouldn't have made junk mortgages. It wouldn't have made corporate takeover loans. It wouldn't have made loans to payday lenders. It wouldn't have made derivative gambles. That's not what a public bank does. This discussion somehow isn't occurring. And it's not occurring because people don't realize that in any economy, not only America, but you're having the same thing in Europe, the volume of debt expands exponentially by compound interest. In other words, all the debt that people owe keep mounting up more and more arrears. And if you miss a payment on your credit card, or if you miss a payment to the electric utility or any of your monthly bills, your credit rate interest goes up from 11 or 12% to 29%. All of this accumulates up and up and up. And the result is that personal debt service relative to income is going up. Corporate debt service relative to income is going way up. And government, the share of government budgets that have to be paid to bondholders and banks is going up. And that means that people don't have enough money to go and buy the goods and services they produce. And that's why here in New York, where I live, there are whole big blocks down 8th Street or Broadway or 5th Avenue or Madison Avenue that more and more stores are empty and for rent because the stores are going out of business. The restaurants especially are going out of business. The big chains have been going out of business, as you've seen, not only Toys R Us, but the whole slew of big global chains and American chains are going out. People do not have enough money to buy goods and services anymore, and all of this is celebrated as saving the bank instead of destroying the economy. So you're having a set of euphemisms as if this keeping the debts in place and not having the debts written down was a victory for the economy when it was really only a victory for the banks and their bondholders, not for the economy at large, which is going to keep limping along until it does what every other economy in similar conditions has done, write down the debt. And if it doesn't write down the debt, then you can look at what's happened in Greece as our future. More and more austerity. The first debts to be wiped out are going to be what companies and states owe to the pension payments. You'll have the pensions wiped out. You'll have Social Security scaled back. The vice is going to be tightening financially on people. That should be what people are talking about when they talk about the disaster of 2008, when essentially the first thing Obama did when he was elected was send a list of recommended cabinet positions to Rubin at Citicorp, and Citicorp got to name the cabinet. And of course it wasn't going to name anybody who would regulate it or any people in justice who would throw a banker in jail. And that's the crisis. It's a political crisis now that is tearing America apart, but it's not a crisis that's being talked about in the press.
You indicated that unless debts are canceled, the economy will suffer debt deflation and austerity, which you've just been talking about. Could you remind everyone what is meant by the term debt deflation?
I have a chapter on that in my book, Killing the Host. The term debt deflation was coined in the 1930s by Irving Fisher. And he said, when the debts are left in place and people are losing their jobs and corporate employment is shrinking and wages are not growing, the debts tend to grow and grow, and more of people's income is diverted to pay banks instead of paying goods and services. So what's happened today is people think of prices as the price that they pay for consumer goods, and that's the consumer price index. But what you have instead is that the Federal Reserve had a choice. It created $4.4 trillion worth of credit, and all of this credit was given to Wall Street. Not a penny was given into the economy at large. So there's been a huge creation of money to pay the banks to enable them to keep the debts, including the bad debts and the fraudulent debts, in place, while this $4.3 trillion could have been used to write down the debts. It could have been used to buy the excess mortgages, to write down the bank mortgages to the realistic value, so they wouldn't be junk mortgages, they'd be realistic mortgages. They could have lowered the cost of housing for people on mortgage. They could have essentially freed most of the economy from debt. And you can imagine, your listeners can imagine, if you didn't have to pay your credit card debt and your student loan debt and your mortgage debt and your other debts to the banks, think of how much better your life would be. Think of all the things you could spend your money on. You'd buy more, and you wouldn't be so badly squeezed. This was the road that could have been taken, but you can't bail out the banks, leave the debts in place, and rescue the economy. It's a zero-sum game. somebody has to lose, and that's what happened in 2009 when President Obama came in. He invited the bankers to the White House, and I give all the quotations in my book, and he said, "I'm the only guy standing between you and the mob with pitchforks." Hillary called her voters the deplorables, but before he called them deplorables, Obama called them the mob with pitchforks. By what he meant, the voters that he was bamboozling when he said, he assured the bankers, he said, "Look, my loyalty is to my campaign donors, not to the voters. Don't worry, my loyalty is with you. I can front for you and screw my voters." I'm paraphrasing what he said there, but what he said was bad enough. He looks at his supporters and the Democratic voters. He called them the mob with pitchforks, and he treated them that way.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Rescuing the Banks Instead of the Economy. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And the result is that the people that he put in place essentially were so pro-Wall Street that he put in place the second big deflationary ploy, which was the Obamacare, which was the Republican health care. People don't realize that a large portion of the Democrats, people elected as Democrats, are actually Republicans running as Democrats. They're called blue dogs, such as Claire McCaskill, the West Virginia senator, Missouri, Heidi Heitkamp. They're basically Republicans. And under Obama, the Democratic Party would only promote Republicans to run as Democrats. They essentially tried to purge the party of anyone who was pro-labor or pro-Bernie, certainly. And you can see what they did to Bernie and what they've continued to do with him. They've made sure that that it is impossible for the voters to select the 2020 Democratic candidate because they've turned over almost all the voting power to the non-elected representatives. They don't get to vote till the second ballot, to be sure, but the second ballot will happen if nobody gets 50%, and there are going to be so many people running that, of course, no candidate's going to get 50% on the first ballot. So essentially, the Democratic Party's been captured by the same Wall Street people that put in President Clinton and Obama. And the result would be that people, to answer your question, that people are their credit card balances are going to keep accruing interest. Their student loans are not going to be canceled. Their mortgage charges are going up as the interest rates are going up. And it's going to be a slow crash. People are just having to struggle. And so already, I think more than half the Americans, according to the Federal Reserve, cannot raise $400 in an emergency. So they're literally one paycheck away from homelessness or disaster or losing their house or missing a credit card payment that'll increase their interest rates from 11% to 29%.
And could you explain what is meant by the term quantitative easing and how does it reinflate asset prices? And I'm thinking right now of the housing market, for instance.
Well, quantitative easing is meant to confuse people. What is the quantity and what's being eased? What it meant is the Federal Reserve went to the bank and said, "Look, you can give us all of your the loans that you've written, mortgage loans, all these junk mortgages, other loans. You can keep your assets with us, and we will count it as a Federal Reserve deposit." So it's a cash for trash swap. And the Federal Reserve has basically, the quantitative easing was to pump $4.3 trillion into bank reserves that banks otherwise wouldn't have had to lend. And the pretense was that this will enable the banks to start lending to factories again, to into the economy, to put people back to work. Now, this is bizarre because for the last 100 years, banks don't lend to build factories. Banks only lend against assets in place. or income that comes in. In fact, almost 70% of capital investment, meaning factories, buildings, is done with retained earnings of corporations. And the other investment is done by stock issues, by the stock market. The banks don't lend to build capital. What they do lend is to corporate raiders to take over companies. So what the Federal Reserve did was create so much credit for banks that interest rates went down to 0.1%. That's what you'd get by lending to the government. The interest rates were zero. What that meant is that banks and their customers can borrow 0.1% or 1%, and they can buy a whole entire company whose, let's say it's stock dividends. They could buy the stock, and the stock dividends are yielding 5, 6, 7, or 8%. So you can borrow at 1% from the Federal Reserve that's just given the $4.3 trillion, and you can use all this money to buy a company on credit. And then all of a sudden, you've replaced the company's stock with a bond because you've borrowed the money, and now it's a debt instead of equity. And once you've bought the company, what do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you try to grab the workers' pension funds, like happened at the Chicago Tribune when you grab their fund and wipe them out. Secondly, you downsize. You try to squeeze out as much profit as you can get by shrinking the labor force, by working it harder, by telling the labor unions, if you go on strike, then we're just going to declare bankruptcy, and that'll wipe out the pension funds that you think we owe you, unless you agree to change your pension program from a defined payout, so you know what you're going to get as a pension, to a defined contribution plan, where all you know is how much you're going to pay in every month. They raise the prices to consumers, and the result is a crapification of the corporations that are taken over. So essentially, the credit that the Federal Reserve has created was given to raiders to crapify the economy, to downsize it, to outsource it, to move their production abroad for cheaper labor, and it became part of the class war of finance versus the rest of the economy. None of this quantitative easing, meaning this money creation, was spent into the economy. It all went into the financial sector, and people talk about money being created by helicopters dropping it down on the economy. The helicopter only flies over Wall Street. That's the key thing to understand. And the Federal Reserve, since it was created to replace the Treasury, was created to shift monetary policy and economic policy out of the hands of Washington, out of the hands of elected officials, into the hands of the banks. And the Federal Reserve acts as the board of directors for the banking system in an adversarial position against the rest of the economy, not for it. And that's why, for instance, Ben Bernanke, who was head of the Federal Reserve under Obama, just wrote a paper a little while ago saying there wasn't any crisis in 2008. There was a panic because people didn't have faith. If you have faith in a system, everything will be okay. There's no underlying problem. So he goes hand in hand with people like Paul Krugman in saying debt doesn't matter because we owe it to ourselves. But of course, who are the ourselves? The debt is owed by the 99% to the 1%, and debt does matter. If you're the 1%, that's why you're growing and the 99% isn't, because the 1% holds the 99% in deepening debt. And that's the situation in which the U.S. economy has locked itself into today.
And how does this procedure reinflate asset prices?
Well, if you can borrow from the Federal Reserve at 0.1%, then you can buy corporate bonds that are yielding 5 or 6%. You can buy stocks. And so all of this money was borrowed to buy stocks and to buy bonds, and that pushed up the price. And also, you could buy mortgages. There are all these mortgages that would have lost money that are paying 5 or 6%, but now you can borrow at 1%, and you can make 4%. You call it, it's the unearned increment. It's the arbitrage that you get from the difference between what you can squeeze out of real estate or a corporation, and what you have to pay the bank. So all this credit was used to inflate asset prices, including the housing prices that people have to pay if you're trying to buy a house. It wasn't used to help people's income and spending on goods and services. It's just to increase the capital gains on stocks, bonds, and real estate. And most of the stock and bond market is owned by the wealthiest 1%. So basically, all of this quantitative easing was creating wealth for the 1% without helping the 99%. And in fact, was almost guaranteeing that most pension funds and even insurance companies and personal savings would fail to provide for the retirement. Because if the quantitative easing bids up bond prices, that means that the bond yield is falling to about 1% for longer-term government bonds for a long time. 0.1% if you want to keep your money safe in short-term treasuries. So all of a sudden, if people were trying to put their money in the banks or in a money market fund to save for retirement, all of a sudden they weren't getting any interest, and all of the mathematical programs that say here's how much a state or a city or a corporate employer has to put aside in order to be able to pay the pensions that it's promised, all of a sudden all these mathematical forecasts were thrown out the window because there wasn't any more interest payment. And that made some pension funds so desperate, they went to Wall Street and said, can't you make more money? And so the Wall Street money managers would take the pension fund money and put them in corporate junk bonds and takeover loans and corporate rating. And so all of a sudden, the pension funds, instead of being used to help labor, were used to help corporate raiders buy companies and fire labor and downsize its working conditions and make the world much harder to survive in.
Well, right. Because if the pension funds were counting on an interest accrual in order to keep the pension fund solvent, but then with no interest, then they're forced to do something else with the money, is what you're saying.
Well, yes, either they get very little money, which is what happened, or they take risks. And there have been many, many lawsuits by state and local pension funds against Wall Street saying, oh, they were tricked. In other words, when the Wall Street boys see a pension fund manager coming in the window, you know, a lot of these people are not quite as sophisticated because Wall Street hires the most sophisticated people. And they look at you like a lawyer would look at you. How much does this client have, and how can I take the money out of his pocket and put it into my pocket? And they were ripped off. And again, the fastest growing banks have been liable for the most civil penalties for fraud, and they've had to settle and said, okay, we cheated you, we have to give you some of the money back. And that's been largely tying up the court system for the last few years in the United States.
You point out that when the debt is so enormous that the banks are not able to collect, that they then gain control of the government to make it pay. And how exactly do they do this?
They want almost 100% of mortgages for houses under about $600,000 now are guaranteed by the Federal Housing Authority. Banks will not make loans on housing or student loans unless the government promises that if the loan goes bad, the government will pay. So the bank take zero risk. Meanwhile, they charge very high student loan rates because they say, oh, they're very risky. But all the risk is on the government. If a student defaults on the loan, and we're having rising default rates on student loans, then the bank not only gets to go to the government and say, give us the money that the students would have paid, but also let us charge enormous penalty fees. And the penalty fees are as high as the interest rate. So the government has to end up paying the banks, making sure that the banks have no risk at all in mortgage loans, student loans, and other loans, because they guarantee, it's like the government countersigns on every loan, just as if somebody's parent countersigned on a student loan, the government countersigns, and it guarantees the banks against loss. So it's a zero-risk operation. Well, if it's zero-risk, you ask, why should they get interest? why shouldn't they just get their fees? If the government's going to guarantee all the loans, why doesn't the government directly have a housing agency making the loans directly, where there's no incentive to write junk mortgages, no incentive to falsify, no incentive to do the criminal activities that Citibank pleaded guilty for, Bank of America pleaded guilty for, Wells Fargo pleaded guilty for, and the other banks. This is simply, it's bizarre.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Rescuing the Banks Instead of the Economy. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that FICA, F-I-C-A, wage withholding and allied taxes are levied to bail out the creditor class. If FICA withholding is supposed to be for Social Security and Medicare, how is it bailing out the creditor class?
I don't remember writing it in exactly that way. I think I must have said FICA and must have added that to all of the government guarantees. The way that the FICA is designed is that only people who earn incomes up to $120,000 have to pay. The rich people, wealthy people, don't have to pay any FICA charges on the high income that they get over $120,000 a year. They don't have to pay any FICA charges for Social Security and tax on capital gains that they make. They don't have to make any FICA payments on income that they make in the United States, but their accountants say they make in Ireland or in offshore banking centers. So essentially, they let the sophisticated financial sector, people who make over $120,000 a year, they don't have to pay. It's all paid for by the bottom 99%, not by the top 1% or even the top 10%.
When a creditor makes a loan, let's say for $100, $100 is then created or put into the money supply. What is not created or put into circulation at the time of the loan is the interest. Where does the money for the interest come from?
That has to be paid out of the borrower's income. So if you borrow, if you spend $100 more on your credit card, you get to spend $100, but then you have to spend, let's say you're just keeping current on your credit card. By the end of a year, you'll have to spend either an extra $19 in interest out of your income, or $29 if you're at the penalty rate and have missed a payment anywhere. So the interest is paid out of income that otherwise would have been spent on buying goods and services.
Let's talk about your famous FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. Generally, how would you describe these three sectors of the economy, and why do you lump them together?
I lump them together because they're basically a symbiotic sector. 80% of bank loans are to the real estate sector. And as a result, I think over 80% of bank income comes from mortgage interest. So essentially, if you are buying a house or selling a house is worth whatever a bank is going to lend you to buy it. And if you go to buy a house and there are other buyers who are going to want to buy the same house, you bid against each other, and the winner is usually the buyer, and same thing for commercial property, who's willing to spend all of the rental value of the house, all of the sort of free lunch rent, is interest. Rent is for paying interest. If you're buying a building, you'll say, okay, here's the rent roll of the building. Here are my expenses. All of the net rent that I get over and above expenses, I can pay the bank for amortization and interest. So the bank will get everything. Now, why would a real estate developer or speculator do that? It's because they expect to make a capital gain, because that's not going to be taxed. It's not taxed if you just keep plowing it back and buying more and more real estate. It's not taxed if you die. It's not taxed if you do all sorts of, if you have a good accountant. So basically, the real estate sector is a function of finance. Same thing with insurance companies. Ever since the 19th century, banks used insurance companies as a sort of front. In the 1830s, 150 years ago, New York State had a huge inquiry into the crooked insurance companies working with the crooked banks. The banks essentially underwrite insurance companies and work with them. So it's a symbiotic sector. The first company that Citibank merged with after Clinton got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act was the Travelers Insurance Company, so that it could combine the operations. Banks have been buying up insurance companies, so if they make a loan to a home buyer, they say, okay, you have to pay us interest on your mortgage, but you're also, here's the insurance that we'll sell you, and you pay the insurance for the home. We won't give you a mortgage unless you buy insurance. And you have to buy insurance so that we know if your home burns down or there's something flooded, we get reimbursed and you get all the risks. So insurance is part of almost every real estate loan. So insurance, finance, and real estate are all part of the same sector.
You write that today's financially dysfunctional economy cannot be saved without a bank crash. So if we don't have a bailout, we don't save the banks, we let them crash, okay? And how does that benefit the economy then?
Well, for one thing, when I talked about the debt problem is what's hurting the economy, you could call this the savings problem. One person's debt is another person's saving. So all the debt that's owed by the 99% is on the other side of the balance sheet, and that's the savings of the 1%. Now, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, insures all of the bread-and-butter depositors, the people who use banks for checking accounts and savings accounts, you know, up to $250,000. A bank crash would wipe out the stockholders, would wipe out most of the bondholders, and would save the insured depositors. It would save the economy, but it would wipe out all of these savings of the 1% that represent the debts of the 99%. The economy cannot recover if the debts of today all remain in place. If people continue to owe all of the credit card debt they owe, all of the mortgage debts they owe, all the car loans they owe, they're not going to be able to increase their spending on things, on goods and services. And if they can't increase their spending on what they produce, there's going to be much less production and fewer stores, fewer sales outlets, and the economy is going to shrink and shrink and shrink, just like it's doing in Greece.
Could you explain how the Eurozone has imposed austerity, Greek style, on itself by limiting deficits of over 3% of GDP, which, of course, the United States doesn't do that?
Well, the United States and England have central banks that can simply monetize a government deficit. So one of the good things that President Obama did as after he created the debt depression was at least to begin running a modest deficit to spend money into the economy. If the private sector is shrinking and not employing people at rising wages, then the government can spend money in, and the government can act all the way up to the employer of last resort. The government can spend to keep the economy fully employed at decent living standards. But Europe is different. The Eurozone was designed by ultra-right-wing politicians. It was basically a fascist plan. Fascist as in the 1930s, fascist as in the Austrian school. They said that we don't want government spending to be inflationary, meaning we don't want government spending to increase wages. Essentially, the Eurozone was created as an anti-labor, very right-wing organization that never could have been done before, and said, we will not let any country run budget deficits, even if there's mass unemployment, even if there are underused resources, even if people are losing their homes. We will not spend money into the economy to help it recover. And they've written that by law into the European Constitution. So they got rid of every country's central bank segregated everything in the European Central Bank that will not let governments run deficits of more than 3%, meaning, you know, very, very small amounts of money. And the European Central Bank has also created about $4 trillion worth of money only for the banks. So the Eurozone is basically a class war against labor. The intention from the Eurozone from the beginning was to break labor unions, to increase unemployment, to make living standards fall by about 20%, to shorten the lifespans, to increase the suicide rates, increase the disease rates, lower the birth rate, and essentially it's all of this was written at the time it was done as if this is the solution to the problem, not a problem in itself. The solution to the economic problem, the Eurozone said, was people are living too well. We have to cut their living standards by 5, 10, 20% so that all the money goes to the wealth creators, namely the financial sector. And that makes it, the plan is really evil. That is the libertarian Austrian economic plan that underlay the Eurozone from the beginning, and the result is what you have in Greece, where the unemployment rate is near 30%, lifespans are shortening, emigration is rising, people are just people in their 20s and 30s are having to leave the country to find work because there's no work there, and the government cannot do what the United States did in the Depression by setting up public works, by public infrastructure spending, by helping the economy recover.
You mentioned in your article the end of history at the close of Roman antiquity and an ensuing dark age. What did the dark age look like economically, and how was it brought about?
Well, the Roman historians, Livy and Plutarch and others, all blamed the decline of Rome on the creditors holding the rest of the economy in debt, foreclosing on the lands, and ended up concentrating all the land ownership in their own hands. So the result was absolute impoverishment throughout the Western Roman Empire, that is, Western Europe. Byzantium was relatively free of this. In order to survive, labor had to become a client of a wealthy creditor or a wealthy landowner, and that was serfdom. And the essence of serfdom was that all of the economic surplus was turned over to the landowner, the landlord, usually a military force. And the serf owed military duty to the landlord, owed the crops to the landlord, and was supposed to be assured the bare minimum subsistence that they needed to live. Well, essentially, that's what we're moving at today. History stopped because progress stopped, investment stopped, literacy stopped. The money economy itself dried up for the 99%. The only money that was spent was among the lords at the top who lived in their manors and would continue to buy luxuries for themselves. But for the vast amount of the population, it was subsistence levels. All of this, the idea of serfdom has been rechristened the end of history by Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book on that a few years ago. And after America defeated Russia in the Cold War and said, well, the neoliberal world is here. All power to the banks. It's a wonderful new world. The banks will take care of us. And history stopped. We don't need any more changes. All we need is to let the new status quo unfold. Well, the new status quo is doing exactly what happened in the Roman Empire. People are falling more and more into debt. They're losing their homes. Home ownership is falling. They're more and more dependent on the employers. The labor unions are losing their power because the workers are afraid to go on strike or even to protest working conditions, because if they protest or strike, they'll be fired and they're one paycheck away from homelessness or losing their house. And so the population has lost its independence, and there's an increasing dependency on employers. The difference is that people can live wherever they want, unlike serfdom. where serfs were tied to the land, but wherever they go, they're tied to pay their economic surplus no longer to the landlords, but to the financial lords, to the banks and to the creditors and the bondholders behind the banks, to the creditor class that holds them in debt through the banking system, the insurance system, the credit system, and the political system, now that politics has been essentially turned over to the donor class instead of the voter class, you have essentially political voting by wealth, meaning by campaign contributions, and a loss of the popular power to protect its own interests in rising living standards.
So in Roman antiquity, all of the wealth was driven to the very top layer, which then led to a serfdom of the population. And it sounds like the same thing is happening today, only on a global level, right?
Yes, that's my point.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Rescuing the Banks Instead of the Economy. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What is your assessment of President Trump's tariff and trade wars?
I've written quite a bit on tariff policy and protectionism. America got rich by a protectionist policy. My book, America's Protectionist Takeoff from 1815 to 1914, is all about that. And my trade theory and foreign debt is all about that. There is a logic for protectionism, but the logic is you want to build up manufacturing and high value added by minimizing the cost of raw materials and the cost of labor. And what Trump is doing is the opposite of what traditional protectionism has advised. Instead of lowering the cost to American manufacturers, he's raised the price of steel, raised the price of aluminum, raised the price of raw materials and other inputs. So this squeezes American manufacturers. And so suppose you're a car maker or you're making beer cans, Canadians, Europeans, Mexicans, producers all over the world who are making cars, refrigerators, beer cans, anything, can now buy aluminum and steel much cheaper than American companies can, so they can afford to make products at a much cheaper rate price than American companies have to charge to break even, and they can undersell the American manufacturers. So what Trump has put in place is a guaranteed unemployment for American heavy manufacturing industry. He wants to spread, his strategy is to spread the Rust Belt from the Midwest to the entire country and make the whole country look like Detroit and the rest. And he doesn't seem to realize that. Nobody's explained to him that there actually is a protectionist strategy, and he's doing it all wrong.
Right. It seems like from what he says, he doesn't understand what he's doing.
One hopes that that's the case. One hopes he's not intentionally wiping out American manufacturing companies. But that's certainly the effect.
Right. And now these tariffs that he's imposing, I mean, these constitute a trade war. Is that right?
That seems to be the case. He thinks it's a trade war. Russia has said, thank you very much for doing a favor. The tariffs go hand in hand with sanctions against Russia and China. And so now the Russians who had moved all their money abroad are now moving it back into Russia. And Russia and China, under the World Trade Organization, would not have been allowed to raise tariffs on particular industries to protect themselves. But now you are allowed under the rules to retaliate against an American act of trade war. So now other countries are legally able to erect tariffs against whatever they choose by an equal and offsetting amount to the American warfare, and this is helping other countries become more independent, especially in agriculture, which I think is very desirable. I think every country should produce its own food supply and its own means of support. So Trump is helping other countries become more independent of the United States, and if they sort of hesitate to do it, he's forcing them to become more independent of the United States by the trade war. He's not letting China use its balance of payments and trade surplus to buy American industries. So China's building these industries at home. So he's spurring the disinvestment in America and the flight of capital out of America into Asia, the third world, Europe.
Well, you just mentioned that President Trump is preventing the Chinese from buying American industries. How is he doing that?
Basically, illegally. He says it's national security. If they buy a filling station, like they wanted to buy some gas stations in California, he says that's national security. He's saying that if we buy Chinese consumer goods that are sold at Walmart, that's a threat to our national security. There is a special clause in trade things that countries are able to present national security. And he said our national security lies in controlling every other country by reducing every other country to let us monopolize the information technology, to us monopolize the world and charge whatever we want, and to reduce them to serfdom. Our national security is threatened if we can't destroy every country economically. So he's defined national security as economic war against humanity. And the Congress has gone along with that and has let them do it. So this is war against humanity. It's war against every other country, saying no country can grow unless all of the result of their growth is paid to American firms and to American, ultimately, American financiers and the 1%, so that the 1% can use that to fight the real enemy, which is the American 99%. And essentially, this is the plan for neo-serfdom.
How do economic sanctions, particularly secondary sanctions, work to bring down an economy?
Well, one way is threatened is if Europe will, European countries and even Chinese countries will buy Iranian oil or trade with Iran or North Korea or anyone that America doesn't like, we can get them out of the SWIFT system of bank clearing. That means that when you write a check to somebody, it all goes through a computerized bank clearing operation. America, even though this SWIFT system of bank clearing is run out of Europe, I think in Luxembourg, the Americans threatened to smash the whole system and break everybody's payment system. It will pull out all the connections of the economy. This is actually, the result is that Russia moved very quickly to create its own alternative to SWIFT, and other countries are making their own clearing system, and their trading system as quickly as possible to become independent of the United States to wreck their economy by sanctions, so that they're going to trade much less with the United States. They're not going to use American banks. They're bypassing the U.S. economy in every way. And so the result of what Trump is doing is literal isolationism. Other countries are not dealing with the American banking system, and they're not becoming dependent on American agriculture, because America will say, we'll do what we did to China in the 1950s. We won't export any grain to you, and we'll try to starve you out. So China's response was, okay, we'll grow our own grain and have an agricultural revolution, which they've done. So essentially, America is trying to say, we will punish any country that buys foreign oil instead of American oil. We want to sell you high-priced American gas, but you want to buy cheap American gas? We will wreck your economy if you will do that. And what he doesn't say, we will also assassinate your leaders who want to do that. We will also, you know, have a political war and interfere with your elections to try to bring pro-Americans on our side and make sure that they're elected. But basically, he'll try to interfere with their food chain, with their supply chain, with their bank transfer mechanisms, with their information technology, if they don't move very quickly to become independent and treat the United States as a pariah country.
I've read that the Trump administration is putting economic sanctions on a Chinese military agency for buying Russian fighter jets and missiles that violates U.S. sanctions on Russia.
I think that's right, yes. America says, China, you have to buy your high-priced airplanes from us. Don't buy. America has a real problem with Russian military. The Russian military is much, much more efficient and technologically superior to that in the United States. And America says, China, we forbid you to buy superior Russian defense systems because we want to be able to atom bomb you to smithereens whenever we want. And we're going to fight against you if you defend yourself. You have to buy high-priced, like F-35s from us that don't work, instead of buying Russian anti-aircraft radar systems that do work. So essentially, it's a trade war with a military fist attached to it.
So then, is the U.S. waging economic warfare on the rest of the world?
Economic, military, demographic, every form of warfare, political, cultural, multidimensional warfare against the rest of the world.
Who do you think President Trump is taking advice from?
Nobody really knows. I guess from whoever gives him the largest campaign contribution, just like any other president, just like Obama or Bush or Clinton. I think they all seem to be up for sale.
Dr. Michael Hudson, thank you very much.
It's always good to be here, Bonnie.
I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show has been Rescuing the Banks Instead of the Economy. Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri-Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid, among many others. His latest books are Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Destroy the Global Economy, and J is for Junk Economics. Dr. Hudson acts as an economic advisor to governments worldwide on finance and tax law. Visit his website at michael-hudson.com. That's michael-hudson.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your light. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks. And release. You dig me? You got me?
Everybody knows.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, the show is about climate change. Here, seldom is heard an encouraging word, but we do have some encouraging words today from climate scientist Tim Flannery. I hope you'll stay tuned. I try to keep a sense of humor about things, but if New World Notes has a fault, that's a joke. The show has about 75 faults. Anyway, if the show has a fault, it is that our installments sometimes are a bit heavy on the gloom and doom, especially when we discuss the ongoing, the unrelenting destruction of the Earth's environment. Global climate change. So, it was a rare delight to find a serious climate scientist who says that the situation is plenty bad, for sure, but maybe we can avoid total disaster. Dr. Timothy Flannery. Tim Flannery is an Australian environmental scientist and climate change activist. He has a new book on the subject titled Atmosphere of Hope: Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. He spoke in Seattle a few weeks ago, in November 2015. Mike McCormick captured the audio of his talk, and I have whittled the hour-long presentation down to about 25 minutes. Flannery offers a large handful of partial solutions. Several of these are high-tech and not yet tested on a large scale. But importantly, these high-tech solutions are not like the scary and dangerous geoengineering schemes that our industrial and military technocrats keep coming up with. Some of the solutions are here now. Solar electricity and windmill electricity are established. They're cheaper than coal, and they work. On the other hand, turning atmospheric CO2 into carbon fiber, well, that technology is not ready for prime time just yet. But it's doable, and it has been done on a small scale. None of these technologies is adequate in itself to halt global climate change. All of them together might still not be good enough. But what the heck, at least they offer and warrant some real hope. At least they could buy us some time to work out better solutions. We will skip over Flannery's own catalog of gloom and doom and pick up at the point where he shifts to the hopeful stuff. Here is Tim Flannery.
So what's changed that gives me hope? I just want to talk about one relatively small thing first, but I think it's quite telling. The International Energy Agency earlier in the year produced a report that really surprised me. And it surprised me because the International Energy Agency is hardly some screaming radical green organisation. You know, it has its own coal unit and its experts in fossil fuel use and all the rest of it. So the report they produced was quite astonishing. What it said, or the bottom line of the report, was basically that in 2014... the global economy grew at a time when emissions from the burning of fossil fuels for energy use stalled. So the fossil fuels we consumed for energy use didn't grow between 2013 and 2014, and yet the global economy grew. This was astonishing to me because we're used to seeing developed countries decouple economic growth from emissions growth. The US has done it, Australia's done it, Canada's done it, Europe's done it. But to think that it would happen at the global scale in 2014 is amazing. No one was expecting that decoupling to occur so early. Two of the drivers, I think, that are responsible for that outcome are, first incredible success of clean energy technologies in terms of penetrating the marketplace. And secondly, what I'll call for the moment energy efficiency, but we'll come back to that. Just to deal with the clean energy first, you know, I've watched year on year as solar panels have been producing cheaper and cheaper electricity. You know, for the last 30 years, they've dropped the price of electricity 10% a year. They've got, you know, it's amazing outcomes. The wind sector has been the same, and the wind sector and solar have got a long way to go. Costs are going down. I work with Siemens, or I have worked with Siemens for a decade, and particularly their wind sector, and I see what they're doing. I mean, they're totally revolutionising the production of wind turbines. They no longer have gears in their wind turbines. They have these gearless wind turbines where the head itself is the turbine. There's hundreds less moving parts. The maintenance costs are way, way down. The blades of wind turbines run out, obviously, and have to be replaced. They're like propeller blades on an aeroplane. You know, they start to corrode over time. What Siemens are doing with these, and imagine a 90-metre-long turbine blade, you know, they're putting little 3D printers on the blades that run all the way up and back and just keep that blade in absolutely top condition. So, again, maintenance costs are down. If you're putting your turbines offshore, that counts a lot. The least maintenance you need to do, the better. So the cost of electricity from wind turbines in future is going to be about half of what it is now. So, I mean, these technologies are just taking over the marketplace. For 3 years running, we've had more investment in clean tech than we've had in fossil fuels in the energy sector. It's an enormous change. So that's part of that decoupling, I think. But the other part that I would argue is at least as important as what I called energy efficiency. In this country, your year of peak oil demand is way, way in the past. In my country of Australia, our year of peak coal demand was 6 years ago. You know, so all of those efficiency gains means that we're using less and less fossil fuels, which is getting us, you know, helping contribute to that decoupling that I mentioned. And I think we deserve a pat on the back. It's nights like this where everyone gets together who has been doing this sort of stuff. We need to recognise we've had a massive success. As kind of tedious as it is doing all of those small things that seem to not add up to anything, they've actually added up to a huge outcome in my view. So I think that's really important. 5 years before the Paris meeting agreement will start to take effect, which is 2020, we're seeing this decoupling. It might just buy us some time that we didn't think we had to get below 2 degrees. But as I said, there's enough gas in the air now to take us to 1.5 degrees of warming, and I really hate that. I hate that fact. I really do, because it's going to cost me my barrier reef and my children the opportunity to see that marvellous thing. And my third cause of hope really came from a meeting that I had in 2007 with Sir Richard Branson. He had read The Weathermakers and invited me to Necker Island, where he has a house, and wanted to talk about climate change and what he could do about it. Back then, I was pretty optimistic we were going to get a good outcome at Copenhagen and we'd be able to get on top of this problem. Richard didn't believe that for a second. He just said, I just don't think that humanity is capable of doing what needs to be done to avoid the problem. He said, what I'd like to do is to set up a prize for technologies that have the capacity to draw enough CO2 out of the air to make a difference to our climate future. So we ended up calling it the Virgin Earth Challenge Prize. It's a £25 million prize, and it's for technologies that have the potential to draw 1 gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere per annum. Now, when he set that up in 2007, I agreed to be a judge on the prize panel, but I was very pessimistic that we'd get entries that would amount to anything. 8 years later, we've had 11,000 entries. I've looked through them, I've carefully evaluated them, and I have become totally convinced that this approach of drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere is going to be an indispensable part of our future. One of the things I found frustrating was that this wasn't being recognised anywhere. We didn't even have a name for this basket of technologies before. You know, some of the approaches people would refer to as geoengineering, others to agricultural practices and so forth, but there wasn't a name. So when I wrote my book, I thought I'll coin a name for this. I'll call it the third way. The reason I called it the third way is that the first and most vital way is reducing emissions. We all recognise that. That's what we've got to do. The second way, however, is geoengineering, but geoengineering in really damaging ways. And I can see that the second way will be used if we dally much longer in this. And let me just explain the sort of geoengineering that people are considering at the moment. One of the options, and probably the cheapest and most widely favoured option, is to inject some sort of sulphur-based chemicals into the stratosphere, which is, you know, 12 kilometres or so above our head, up where the jetliners fly. If you do that, you have an instant effect cooling the planet. We know that because large volcanoes sometimes erupt sufficient sulphur into the stratosphere to cool Earth, and we get these years without a summer. We know that happens. There's enough research being done on those options to show that it's really quite cheap. There's a few people who are probably living within 20 miles of us now who could individually fund a geoengineering proposal like that would change the climate of the Earth. It's not that expensive, and there's probably more than one that could do it. So we know it's cheap. We know it's instantly effective, right? It really does lower the temperature straight away. So if you're facing some dire problems related to temperatures, you can fix them. The third thing we know about the second way, geoengineering, using sulphur and so forth, is that it is incredibly dangerous. It's dangerous because it has the potential to change Earth's weather circulation patterns. So we know that if you put sulphur into the stratosphere, you'll affect the South Asian monsoon. There's 1.4 billion people who depend upon that monsoon for a living. We know that the productivity of crops will decline. It's what's happened in years without a summer in the past when the sulphur's gone up naturally. And we know that underneath that sulphur, the problem of climate change will just keep festering away. The CO2 will keep increasing, the oceans will acidify, the very basis of life itself will be eroded. And if anyone decides that they've got to stop putting the sulphur up precipitously for any reason, the rebound in the climate system is likely to be extremely dangerous. The bad news is that there are a number of government agencies worldwide working on geoengineering solutions. The government of China alone has four major institutes or four major research groups working on these geoengineering solutions. China is likely to be quite severely affected by climate change, and China is run by technocrats and engineers who understand that problem very well, and they're hedging their bets. So the second way is something we want to avoid. The third way technologies I outline in the book are really different from the second way. They're all characterised by approaches, methods or technologies that strengthen Earth's self-regulatory system by pulling excess CO2 out of the atmospheres in ways that the Earth system already uses, or in ways that basically simulate or mimic the way the Earth system operates. So it's dealing with the problem at base. I want to explain about some of those 11,000 solutions that we've seen in the prize, and also some others that have come in subsequently. All of the approaches, all of the third way approaches, really fall into two basic categories. One is, I can call the biological pathways. They depend upon sunlight as their power source and plants as the capture mechanism. They're really, really well understood. You know, reforestation, growing plants and somehow storing the carbon. I think that first example I gave you about Australia and how many trees you need to plant to draw down 4 gigatons gives you a sense of the limits of the biological systems, though. You know, we're already asking Earth's system, particularly its land-based ecosystems, to feed us and house us and clothe us, provide our clean water and fresh air and everything else. So there are limits to the amount I think we can do on land when we're dealing with a problem that is of many gigatons in scale. I think they'll contribute, but I don't think they'll be the full answer. So reforestation, it'll be an important tool, but it won't provide the full answer. It can't. It's just not of a scale that allows it to do it. The biochar industry, fantastic industry, and there's been great advances made here in the US and other parts of the world, is another option. And with biochar, you take plant matter, turn it into charcoal, put it in the soil, and the carbon will stay there long term, so it's out of the atmosphere, drawn out by the plants and then put into the soil. The old wood chemistry industries that used to be so prolific in this country might make a comeback. Now, before we had the petrochemical industries, we got all of our plastics and many of our other chemicals from the old wood chemical industry. Chemists knew how to take cellulose and various other plant products and make a lot of valuable products from them. It may be that we'll start doing that at scale. Maybe that'll get us some gigatons, but it won't get us anywhere near where we need to be. You really have to leave the land surface and go to the oceans if you want to have great opportunity in terms of this. But with that great opportunity comes a vast increase in the unknowns and the uncertainties. The seaweed that grows off the coast here in Seattle, that can grow at the rate of half a metre a day. It grows 30 to 60 times faster than any land-based plants. And there was a great study done last year suggesting that if we could only cover 9% of the world's oceans in seaweed farms, we could draw down all of the atmospheric CO2 we put up in any one year. So offset completely the current emissions. And also, because the seaweed takes CO2 out of the atmosphere and buffers the ocean waters and makes them less acid, we could grow enough high-quality protein in the form of fish and seashells and prawns to give 200 kilograms per year to a population of 10 billion people. So I thought, that's fantastic. This sounds like the silver bullet that we've all been looking for, you know. But then I started looking into the problem a bit and thinking about it a bit more seriously. 9% of the world's oceans turns out to be a not insubstantial area. It's about 4.5 times the size of Australia, to be honest. So, you know, we have about 500 square kilometres of seaweed farms off China. When there's mixed aquaculture and seaweed farming, we sort of know how they work, but to go from that to even 1% of the world's ocean is an unbelievably large exercise. And then, you know, it occurred to me, what would we do with all of that seaweed? Are we just going to have it laying around in rotting piles or what? One option that's available is you could put the seaweed into biodigesters and you know, make methane, which you'd then burn for electricity and send the electricity onshore, and then maybe take the CO2 from the tailpipe, and where would you put it? Well, one option that's it's only a desktop study at this moment is that you could try to put it in sediments in the ocean, maybe 1 or 2 miles down, and at that depth, the CO2 remains liquid. The pressure of the water column above it means that the CO2 doesn't try to escape all the time. So it's quite different from putting CO2 into land-based rocks, where, you know, there it's buoyant, it wants to escape. But in the ocean, that's not the case. And eventually it would form a solid in those sediments. But this is all just thinking. It's desktop at the moment. But it's possible. I want to just go now to the chemical-based technologies, which are the second great silo, really, of third-way approaches. I call them chemical because they're very, very broad, but they all have one thing in common. They need an energy source, right? And that energy source at the moment is human-created electricity or transport fuels, you know, fossil fuels, to some extent. The first that we need to think about is carbon-negative concretes. I don't know whether any of you have heard of these, but the concrete industry globally is responsible for about 5% of current emissions of greenhouse gases. People have invented this new product called carbon-negative concrete, which over its lifetime, as it sits there and cures, it absorbs CO2 into its structure, so it gives us a gain in terms of reducing CO2. Its manufacturers claim that it's, you know, cheaper, stronger and more durable than conventional concretes. So why aren't we all rushing out to use carbon-negative concretes? Well, tragically, or perhaps not so tragically, engineers and others involved in building things are pretty conservative in their approach. They know what Portland cement-based concretes do, and we've got a history going back to Roman times. We know the stuff stands up, right? So no one's going to go out and build a Sydney Harbour Bridge or a World Trade Centre out of carbon-negative concrete at the moment because it doesn't have a track record, you know. But there are things we could do to try to foster that industry. If we had a sectoral cap-and-trade system just on the concrete sector, that would encourage the manufacture of carbon-negative concretes in low-risk environments where we could learn about its behaviour over time and start giving it that track record that it needs to start replacing Portland cement-based concretes. So there's a huge opportunity there. That opportunity really is on the gigaton scale. The second opportunity in the chemical pathways involves a particular rock type called serpentinites, and I suspect there's quite a lot of serpentinites in this area. They're rocks that form at the mid-ocean ridge, and over geological time they get incorporated, some of them at least, into continents and become just part of the landscape around us. As those serpentinites weather, they capture CO2 from the atmosphere, and it's a really important part of nature's way of getting rid of CO2 out of the system. If you could quarry and grind up 5 or 6 gigatons of serpentinite, you'd capture 3 or 4 gigatons of CO2. So it's quite a substantial amount. But, of course, the way we quarry things today, you've got to, you know, burn fossil fuels, basically, to drive those trucks and then drive the hammers that'll break the stuff up, or the mills that break the rock up. But serpentinite is not just a kind of a desktop study. There is a company in the Netherlands at the moment who makes roofing paint, who includes serpentinite in their roofing paint and sells carbon-negative roof paints. Great idea. Never going to add up to a gigaton, but it's a good start. But there are people who are thinking, well, why don't we grind this stuff up on scale and use it to replenish beaches, use it as a substitute for beach sand? Because in an active environment like that, it'll start sequestering quite a lot of CO2. Other people think we can use it in playgrounds or as a soil amendment. There's yet others who think maybe we could use serpentinite in the smokestacks of shipping, so that you could capture CO2 from a smokestack, but then drop the serpentinite into the oceans where it'll continue to absorb CO2 out of the ocean water. There's a lot of options there. And I think the greener that we can make our energy sector, the more prospective these opportunities look. You don't want to be burning fossil fuels to capture CO2, but if we can green up our electricity generation and our transport, then I think there's some real opportunities. The other options they're kind of much more prospective, but I do want to just cover off on them. I've held in my hand a little mobile phone cover made of plastic that was created out of atmospheric CO2. I know it's probably the most expensive mobile phone cover in the known universe. In fact, it certainly is, but it exists. You know, people are making plastics out of carbon dioxide drawn from the atmosphere. There's capture mechanisms that are very well known. We can incorporate the CO2 into products. It all takes energy, of course, but those plastics are solidified atmospheric CO2. They're a great way of getting CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it. If every bit of plastic we created today was made out of atmospheric CO2, you would need to double world plastic production to pull a gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere. That's about 4 gigatons of CO2. But it'll contribute, I think, over time. Just in the last 2 months, we heard about another fantastic breakthrough, the manufacture of carbon fibres from atmospheric CO2. Now, here in Seattle, you've got to know about carbon fibres. Boeing uses them in their Dreamliner, you know, as the skin of the aircraft. They'd be more widely used if they were cheaper, right? But they're expensive. This technology of creating carbon fibres out of atmospheric CO2 is reported to be able to create those fibres at a fraction the cost of current production methods. Some estimates may be a tenth the cost. That's a massive breakthrough, because once carbon fibres get cheap enough, they'll start competing head-on with aluminium and steel, and they're both really energy and carbon-intensive sectors. So they're taking a problem, atmospheric CO2, and turning it into a very powerful solution. I think, you know, who knows where that'll lead? Who knows? It's just a bare announcement at the moment, but I think there's real potential there. At the other wacky end of the scale, I need to mention this, but the South Korean researchers about 6 weeks ago made an announcement that they had discovered a way of activating used coffee grounds to capture atmospheric methane, right? Something I never occurred to me in my whole life could be possible, but they have done it. And, you know, I guess if the Arctic starts melting and lots of methane goes in the atmosphere, we'll all be drinking 100 cups a day and sending the stuff off to South Korea to get activated, and hopefully we'll have some sort of solution. But I just bring it up because it tells you we're at the very beginning of an industry here. And think about it this way, that we know that the CO2 in the atmosphere now will be driving ever more disastrous climate change through to 2050 and beyond. We know that, right? And what that means, we know what the problem is that our children will be trying to solve in 2050, right? We know the third way technologies, at least some of them, are the only way forward to deal with this. But we know also that there's long development pathways for all of these industries. Wind and solar teach us that. You know, it's going to be 30 years before we're at scale with the most prospective of these industries. So we need to start investing now. We need to start reducing emissions at the same time we invest in third-way technologies so they're at scale when we use them. I tried to do an assessment of what I thought, a conservative assessment, I should say, of what I thought third wave technologies might be doing in terms of CO2 reductions by 2050. And I came up with a figure that was around about 40% of current emissions. If we can achieve that, it would be stunningly important because it'll help us avoid that 2 degrees of warming. But when I really asked myself honestly whether I'd done a good job with that, I began to doubt it because I thought, I don't know what 2050 is going to be like. I really don't. The only way I can begin to come at it is to throw myself back a century. So let me imagine I'm living in 1915 and I'm trying to imagine 1950 rather than living in 2015 and trying to imagine 2050. And if you do that thought experiment, it's very interesting because in my city of Melbourne in 1915, horse-drawn power was the power on the streets. There may have been a few very early motor vehicles, but horse-drawn power was doing most of the work. The maps that people would have looked at to understand the world in school in 1915 were sort of colour-coded maps that were of countries that were colour-coded according to the empires of Europe that had been there for centuries. There wasn't a single communist country on those maps. You know, the war that was being fought, and my grandfather fought in the First World War, the war that he fought was being fought with cavalry charges in 1915, in part. There wasn't a single tank on a battlefield anywhere in the world in 1915. There was a few biplanes flying up, you know, around the place, and they were used for surveillance, but the generals were saying, oh, they're not really as good as the cavalry surveillance we used to get in the good old days, you know. So imagine that mindset, and then imagine 1950. Nuclear weapons, jet aircraft, half the world living under communism. To someone living in 1915, that would have read as science fiction, right? The changes were just too vast. So when I think about 2050, I think about it in those terms, but also with the knowledge that social, technological and environmental change have all accelerated this century. So when I did a conservative estimate of what might be happening in 2015, I have to admit to myself, I think it is really well and truly conservative. I suspect we will be astonished by what our children will do in 2015, and they'll do it with tools that will utterly transform the total economy. The opportunity that's been created with the tech boom and the green energy boom so far will look like small beer compared with the challenge the third wave presents, because we can count the outcoming gigatons. We know the scale. We know how broad-based these technologies are. They cover almost every sector of the economy. And we know that, you know, if we want to reduce atmospheric CO2 by just one part per million, that's 18 gigatons we've got to take out of the atmosphere. You know, we're already pretty much at 400 parts per million. We know that we started the Industrial Revolution at 280 parts per million. The scale of the challenge is massive, but I have no doubt that the third way can deliver real outcomes. So thank you very much. I'll finish there and take questions.
Australia's Dr. Timothy Flannery, sounding a rare note of hope on climate change. Now it's time for us to skedaddle. On behalf of our entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. We're on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Since we're rapidly approaching the 17th anniversary of 9/11, I thought I'd review some of the evidence and people that have influenced the 9/11 truth community. Today you'll hear part of a speech given by Willie Rodriguez, a janitor who worked at the World Trade Center and was there on 9/11, tell about his experience and why he questions the official story of 9/11, which, by the way, is a conspiracy theory. He was in the first sub-basement of the World Trade Center Twin Towers on 9/11 and heard and felt explosions going off in the basement before a plane hit the buildings. He told his story to many around the world and even to the 9/11 Commission, but they never included his testimony in the 9/11 Commission report, which, if you've been paying attention, you know is a fraud and cover-up from start to finish. Many of the 9/11 commissioners themselves have said that they were set up to fail, were obstructed, and that we don't know the truth about 9/11. And author Philip Shannon, in his book The Commission, also pointed out that Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, had the outlines for all the chapters written up before the commissioners had even met. The 9/11 Commission report doesn't even mention World Trade Center Building 7, the third building to collapse on 9/11 and that wasn't hit by a plane. So here's Willie Rodriguez to tell you his story. The audio clip you're about to hear was taken from a speech given in 2006 at a health and freedom conference put on by the Freedom Law School. It's been lightly edited. So here he is, Willie Rodriguez.
Welcome. My name is William Rodriguez. I am the last survivor of the North Tower. I work at the World Trade Center for 20 years. I was just the janitor in charge of all the stairwells in the building. My duties was to clean the stairwells. And on 9/11, of course, my life totally changed. I was recognized at the White House for those efforts. Now, but I want to talk a little bit about the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission is a book of 576 pages and 576 pages of lies, because the 9/11 Commission exists because I went with three other people to Congress to ask that we wanted a formal investigation of the events of 9/11. And you may remember that the president said, we don't need an investigation, we know who did it. That was the wrong thing to say to the families. We had the right, and we wanted to know. So we pressed for an investigation. They didn't want it. So we used a technique that they have used against a lot of the people with the excuse of the war. We put widows. We put wives. We put fathers that love their loved ones on every television show and every news network to ask for an investigation. And they couldn't handle the emotional toll that that will create on the American public. So we got the investigation. I testify behind closed doors. They didn't want me to do the testimony in an open hearing. Everything else, everybody else, open hearings. You saw the hearings. Mine was behind closed doors. I agree because I did not know what was the process. And I thought up to that point that they were going to do the right thing. We created the Family Steering Committee, and we gave the commission 168 questions to answer. We only have 22 of those questions answered. We wanted to have a family member to be part of the commission, and they say, we don't want to allow that because they will have access to national security papers and a lot of flim-flam and balonies. We never got it. So we have to press for questions to be answered. We never got those answers. Up to that point, we thought that they were going to do the right thing. The final report shows up. What a surprise. My whole testimony was omitted. It doesn't appear. 27 people that I gave them to interrogate, they didn't call, not even one of them. Now the families are angry. They finish their report, and that's when the whole fight starts. Recognized at the White House, I was being trained for politics because they wanted to use the image. I'm in the news in New York almost every week as a leader of the families. So they saw an opportunity to have a political ally and to use the pointing the finger to the IRS. And then I went over to Hillary Clinton and say, Mrs. Clinton, I'm going to make a protest in front of the federal building in Lower Manhattan. I will put 5,000 people. And she said, don't do that. Don't. I said, well, what do you propose? He said, well, what about an amnesty? He said, I like the idea. So we work on something called the Tax Relief Act for victims of terrorism, which actually erases or eliminate the taxes for 2 years for any victim of terrorism. Doesn't mean only World Trade Center victims, but anything that happens after 9/11. So any victim right now will have that a pardon. And again, I didn't know the whole thing about the IRS. But anyway, we got an amnesty, which is good. And became the media expert for the newspapers. Telemundo in New York, I'm the expert for them. CNN en Español. And something very interesting happened. As I was pulled from the rubble, I told my story that I will tell you now, exactly the same. The international press presented without any editing. The local press, or the national press over here, did edit it. Now, that's when I work on the legislation for getting the orphans scholarship programs, and again, it was approved in record time. And this is when I asked Elliot Spitzer to do an investigation of the 9/11 Commission omissions, and you probably heard about that. Now, let's go on to this. Let me tell you what happened. On 9/11, I wake up late. I was supposed to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning. A miracle by itself. Because every morning, I will go and have breakfast at Windows of the World, which was a restaurant that was located on the last floor of the North Tower. So all those people that died over there were my friends. I came in at 8:30 in the morning, and I told my supervisor, I'm on the way. He said, make it, because we don't have anybody, nobody else wants to do your routine. You know what it is to do 110 floors of stairs? Nobody wanted to do it. They will do it, and they will be trembling for 2 days, their knees. Yeah. So I made it, and the office was located on the B1 level. We have six sub-levels at the World Trade Center, B1, B2, all the way down to B6. Our support office was on B1. Now, Building 1, North Tower, and the South Tower connected through the basement. As I'm talking to the supervisors, F-46, we hear, boom! Huge explosion. It was so hard that pushed us upwards from the floor. We went up. All the walls cracked. The false ceiling completely fell down. The sprinkler system got activated. And there was screaming all over it. And at that moment, I thought that it was a generator that blew up on the B2 level, because we had the mechanical room with all the pumps. All the electrical power for the building was located in there. So it made not only sense, but remember, I was in the building for 20 years. I could tell the difference of something coming from the bottom and something coming from the top. So when I went to verbalize that something blew up, probably in the mechanical room, we hear, pa, all the way on the top. The impact of the plane. Two different events. There was an explosion in the basement prior to the tower being hit by a plane. Now, don't take my word for it. Anything that I'm going to tell you right now is out there, because we said it on 9/11. Not only me, the firemen, first responders, and victims that came out of the building. Now, we hear that impact on the top, and everybody started screaming, the 14 people in general in the office, and all of a sudden we hear a person coming like this with the hands extended saying, explosion, explosion. And when I looked at him, he has all the skin pulled from under his armpits all the way to the top of the fingertips, and it was hanging like it was a piece of glove. When you take off a glove and let it hang, exactly like that. I thought it was clothing when I realized it was his skin. When I finally look at his face, he got missing parts on his face. I said, what happened? He was in shock. He said, the elevators. I said, I don't understand. So I went to pick up, don't move. I went to pick up the phone to call the EMS unit that was located on the South Tower. And when I go to pick up the phone, another explosion on the top, and the walls cracked more, and everything started to shake. So I said, we got to get out. I took the guy, it was a black guy named Felipe David. That's Felipe. And I let everybody out. We went out through the loading dock. We get outside. There's an ambulance coming over. We stopped the ambulance. I put Mr. Felipe David, a guy from Bolivia, who was on the B2 level. He was in charge of filling up the machines with water in the building, the vending machines, and with sodas. And as he was in his room, in his closet, he said there was fire. And he put his hands to cover his face because of the huge explosion. And that's how he made it. He tried to make it through the elevator, and he couldn't make it. So he went up the stairwells, one flight up, and that's how he went to my office. So I took him out, put him in the ambulance. He goes into a coma in the ambulance. There's one I hear for the first time. A plane hit the building. A security guard was standing right next to me with a radio. And that's when I look up for the first time, and I see the hole, the debris coming down, the fire. But from the angle of vision that I had, because I was right at the corner of the base of the building, you couldn't see the antenna. So I went crazy. I said, we got to go up, because I thought right away of the people from Windows of the World. He said, we got to go up. And those 14 people that I took out, they started, no, you stay here. My supervisor, a guy three times my size, weightlifter, he was like, Rodriguez, you're not going in there. You stay here. He said, no, we're going in. No, you stay here. So I took the radio from the security guard, who I knew, and I ran inside the building through the loading dock, down the hill, went inside, and there was water all over. Now, water all over on the basement. How come there wasn't water on the top floors? Again, an explosion on the basement. Now, I get to the South Tower because after the 1993 bombing, they created something called the OCC of the Operation Control Center on the South Tower. They spent $153 million to retrofit the building. And so I wanted to tell them that I had a person that was wounded outside the building. So when I get there, there's nobody in the office. I'm hitting the bulletproof window. Nobody answers. I found a guy called Jimmy Barrett that worked for the maintenance company, who was on the lower basement from the South Tower, who did not know what was going on. He was like, what's happening? And I told him what I heard and what I heard on the radio. And he couldn't believe it. So that gives you an idea of how many people probably died on the sub-levels without knowing ever what was going on. Now, I told him, you got to get out. There was a lady at the entrance to the Marriott Hotel on the basement that heard the whole thing but did not dare to leave her post because she was a new worker and she was afraid that she was going to be fired. I said, you got to get out now. I said, no, I'm new. Get out now. There's nobody here. As I left the South Tower, I ran again towards the North Tower. When I get to the North Tower, you know how the freight elevators are? That it has, it's not a regular roof, it's just a mesh. That's exactly because all the water was going very easily in. So I said, God, please help me. I was not a spiritual person. I was not. And at that moment, I found in an area that was supposed to be clean of any construction debris, a huge metal pipe. I took that pipe, put it against the door, forced the door open, and when it opened up, the door is open this way, because it's a freight elevator. When the door is open, the bottom door, when it gets to the bottom, makes all the water on my side to rush in. It's empty by itself because the elevator is down. When I peek down, I see way below these two people standing on a wood log with water up to here. And I said, oh my God, what is this? I'm still not comprehending what's going on. And I said, God, help me. Again, because they're screaming, help, 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 and looking up. You see these eyes practically coming out of their faces. And I didn't know how to get down there. So when I said, God, please help me, I remember right away that in the area where they have the trash compactors, the electricians always had ladders. But they always tied them up with chains so people would not steal them, because it was easy to come inside the loading dock with the truck, put a ladder inside, and take it. So they always tied them up with chain. So I said, let me find one. Please, let me find one. And I ran there. And the incredible thing is that the only one that was not chained was the longest one of all the ladders, an 18-foot long ladder, which I took, aluminum ladder, I took it, dropped it inside the elevator shaft, went inside, opened the grid, got them both out, took them outside the building, put them in an ambulance, and went back inside the building, again through the loading dock running, because my concern again was how to help the people of Windows of the World. And I'm like, my friends, my God, my friends, and I'm screaming, we got to go back in. Nobody wanted to go in. So I said, I'm going again. So I went in, and I found police officer David Lim from the Port Authority Police. He was in charge of the K-9 unit. He meets me there. He said, Willie, and stays quiet. I said, what's going on? He said, I don't know. He said, do you have the key? I said, yes. He meant, did I have the key, the master key? There were only 5 master keys in the building. The people with the other 4 were trained on egress, escape, rescue efforts, and they were the first one to run out. Yeah. I was just a janitor. And the reason that I had that key was because I sued the Port Authority in 1997 because I fell down the stairwells and they couldn't find me for like 3 hours. And I won the arbitration and they had to give me the key. And that key opened the whole complex. So, of course, the Port Authority Police knew, because it was a high security level key, that I had it. So I said, let's go. We get to the lobby. Now, all the firemen are there waiting with something called the fire access key, which is a key that they put in any elevator. And if the elevator is up, we'll go down. If it's down, we'll go up to pick them up. So they're there waiting for the elevator. I said, forget about the elevator. There's no elevator. Follow me. I know the best way. And I have the key to the stairwells. Follow me. So this whole unit, ladder 6, follows me as we start going up the stairwells. Now, it was so difficult because these poor people, talking about the firemen, they have so much equipment in their back. We're talking about 70 to 150 pounds of equipment between machines to open doors, machine to break things, you know. It was so hard to go up because people were coming down and kept bumping into us. The stairwells were, we only had 3 stairwells, A, B, and C. B was the longest one of them. And as we make it over there to the 3rd floor, we have to stop and regroup because it was so difficult. So I said, let's go by the A staircase, which was the one that faced the area that the building was hit by the plane. So we start going up, and now we start the odyssey. We have to go and open every single door. Now, I'm going to tell you why. The World Trade Center was a Class A building. For anybody in construction here, will understand that Class A building means that three doors, one open, one will open. Three won't open, one will open all the way to the top. The reason they do that is because it's a skyscraper over, 27 floors high. They have to have that safety to encapsulate a fire, because otherwise a fire will consume a building going up, the fire. So they do that. They will sacrifice maybe a floor or two, but everybody else will be safe. So that's why opening those doors was crucial. I want to show you these are the stairwells. It's not big. Look at that. No re-entry. Next re-entry, 43 and 39 floor. Huh. The problem was that the World Trade Center was such a tall building, a city within a city, that a lot of people, the turnaround was constant. People getting fired, people getting hired, people retiring, was a constant. So a lot of people didn't even know where the exits were. They made drills only two times a year. They should have had mandatory drills so people will know every time that they will go to work for the first time where to escape. They didn't have that. That's one of the recommendations that we made to the National Institute on Safety and Technology. Now, we start going up, and it was so hard because these poor people couldn't continue at the same pace as I was going. I had no equipment in my bag. I have no fireproof clothing that made it difficult. I had just my uniform, and I did the stairwells every single day. So physically, at that time, I was very skinny. Very, very skinny. I was sometimes two or three floors above the fire department, opening doors, going in the offices, screaming for people to follow my voice, letting people out. As I went up, we heard explosions on the third zone. The third zone is from 44 to 1. You have 110 to 78, 78 to 44, 44 to 1. The building was divided that way. When I asked, what are those explosions? And he said, oh, maybe the gas tanks in the kitchens. It was a Class A building. Only electrical kitchens are allowed. All right? The smell was horrible, was putrid, was, imagine ammonia and sulfur getting stuck in your throat. That's exactly how it smelled over there. And shocking moment was that a person comes down and said, we have a person on a wheelchair on the 27th floor that cannot breathe. I go down two flights below and I tell the fire department, they told me that they have a person on a wheelchair. What can we do? He said, don't worry, we'll make it there. And he explained, we always leave the handicaps for the last. So they didn't have power. They just took their jackets, their equipment, they dropped it on the floor. And I remember that some of them even took their boots and they laid down. And it was so sad just to see that. And David Lim tells me, the police officer, Willie, do you know this floor? I say, yeah. I say, where can we get water? He said, well, there's a machine, a vending machine on the other side. So let's go. He breaks the machine. We start taking the water, putting them in trash cans, and we distribute them to the firemen. I get the opportunity, because there was power in there, to pick up a phone and call my mother. I wanted to call my mother in Puerto Rico to let her know that I was okay in case she heard something. Little did I know was that everybody knew what was happening but us. She picked up the phone and said, what are you doing? Get out of there. I said, Mom, I'm okay. Nothing has happened to me. There's an accident here. And I'm helping the fire department. He said, that's not your job. Get out. I said, Ma, I have the key. These people don't know what they're doing. They don't know the building. Because there was total disorientation. Everybody was knew what was going on. Chain of command over there didn't work. So I said, don't worry, I call you later. I'm not going to make it to the fire. I'm just going to take them to a certain point, and I'm coming down. But I cannot give them the key. So hang up the phone. On the radio, I have my supervisor, Rodriguez, William Rodriguez, abandon the building right now. I continue. Since they stay there, I continue going floor by floor, opening, letting people out, until I stop on the 33rd floor. Why the 33rd floor? Because on the 33rd floor, I had a closet with all the supplies. Every 16th floor, I had a little cubicle to put stuff for the stairwells. And there I have like the paper mask that I use for the cleaning. So I wanted to give those paper masks to the people coming down the stairwell. Now, mind you, the people that is coming down, some of them are cut in their face because they're sitting in front of the offices with a window. Some of them are joking because they're nervous. But that hysterical thing that everybody talks about, that never happened. I guess everybody was in shock because nobody expected this. And we didn't know what was going on. So I continue going up and get to the 33rd floor. I find a lady trembling on the floor on a fetal position. She had no shoes. I said, "What are you doing there?" And she said, "I don't know where to go." I stood her up, put her on the stairwell. There were a couple of people coming down. I remember people from the cafeteria of the 44th floor. And I say, "Take her out." And at that moment, on the corridor, I hear something very strange. On the 34th floor, I hear stuff being moved around. And heavy stuff. You know, like those metal dumpsters scratching the floor? Really heavy stuff. Now, why was it strange? Because the 34th floor was a floor that was got out by the construction crew of the World Trade Center, and it was closed. In other words, elevators did not stop there. There was no walls. There's nothing there. And for those people that, you know, maybe are not in construction, that's what a building does. When a tenant moves out, they got it out, and they make the money redesigning the place to the specification of the new tenant. So to hear this is the first time that I felt fear on that day. So, of course, I knew somebody was there. So I bypassed that floor and continued to the upper floors. People screaming. People, to this day, I guess the biggest pain and nightmare that I will have is just to hear the screams of people still stuck in the elevator, claiming for help.
And again, you were just listening to janitor Willie Rodriguez discussing his experiences on 9/11 in the World Trade Center complex. In 2006, speaking at the Health and Freedom Conference put on by the Freedom Law School. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that speech. The 9/11 Truth Movement is alive and well, thanks to people like Willie Rodriguez, courageous people, and all the researchers who have done all of the research and gathered mountains of evidence disproving the official accounts of 9/11 over the last 17 years. And there will be lots of events going on around the country. There's several things going on in New York City on 9/11. We will be holding a vigil here in West Hartford on 9/11 at 5:30 in the center of West Hartford. For more information on all of these, you can go to the website 911tap.org. 911tap, that's T-A-P, 911tap.org. And just click on events there and you'll see what's going on. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Welcome to part two of our Building Bridges special, Puerto Rico, a junto by any other name.
Well, Hurricane Maria's winds roared across the island, destroying Puerto Rico's infrastructure, and in its wake, more than 3,000 people would die. So, too, are the evil winds of colonialism in the form of the U.S. Congress's imposition of its fiscal control board, a dictatorial junta ravishing the island and threatening its people.
However, 1 year after Maria, the Puerto Rican diaspora is charting a new path forward, vibrantly proclaimed as hundreds gathered in Manhattan's Union Square for an event organized by a community-led initiative called hashtag Our Power PR NYC, created to call out injustices in the U.S. government's response to Maria. Again and again, speakers at the event called for the island's people to be able to chart their own future and escape the federal government's grip. They took to the mic calling to drop the debt, eliminate the Jones Act, a transition to renewable energy that leaves no resident behind, a Marshall Plan type effort to help Puerto Rico recover economically, and for self-determination of the island. In response, a voice in the audience called out, "We need independence. Say it. It's the only answer."
Now, Puerto Rico, a junta by any other name. Puerto Rico, a nation of resilience and resistance.
I would like to welcome to the stage. She's an internationally recognized Puerto Rican attorney and leader for environmental and climate justice. She's co-chair of the Climate Justice Alliance, the organizer of this gathering that we are able to be part of today, the executive director of UPROSE, Brooklyn's oldest Latino community-based organization. Please welcome Elizabeth Yampierre.
I'm a descendant of struggle. All these opportunities that we were able to get, struggle made that possible. We can never forget who our people are and what we are supposed to use that education for, to make sure that another generation stands up on this mic, so that we are intergenerational, so that we are building a leadership continuum, so that we are leaderful, but that we all have power to lead together, to be anchored in the traditions of our people. So that's really who I am. I'm a child of struggle. So, you know, I'm somebody who doesn't like people speaking for our people. But what this sister has done is she has worked with us in the most respectful way. She has used her power, her voice, her international profile to lift our people and not to speak for our people. And this sister, Naomi Klein, wrote a book called Battle for Paradise. And all the funds from that book are going straight to PR. So join us in a rousing applause for Naomi Klein.
Elizabeth, I love you. Thank you so much. Puerto Rico, even before Hurricane Maria, was a textbook case for disaster capitalism, or what I've called the shock doctrine. Before those fierce winds came, the debt, illegitimate, was the excuse used to ram through a brutal program of economic suffering. All levels of education, healthcare, the electricity, water, and transit systems, communication networks, and more. With every Puerto Rican institution already trembling from the junta's assaults, Maria's ferocious winds came roaring through. Puerto Rico broke. Not the people, but all the systems, power, health, water, And that is what took away so many precious lives. When you systematically starve and neglect the very bones of a society, make them so dysfunctional on a good day, then they have absolutely no capacity to weather a crisis. This is why so many precious lives were lost. It was health networks so diminished, they were unable to provide medicine for curable diseases. It was an electricity grid that collapsed, which meant that so many people couldn't plug in vital respiratory machines and more. It was people abandoned and left without hope. Today, I heard a lot of talk about how many people had died from a natural disaster, or I heard talk of an act of God. The truth is that there is nothing natural about this disaster. God is not the one who laid off thousands of skilled electrical workers in the years before the storm and failed to maintain the grid with basic repairs. That was the fatal logic of neoliberal economic austerity. God didn't give vital relief and reconstruction contracts to politically connected hack firms who didn't even pretend to do their jobs. The Trump administration did that. God also didn't decide that Puerto Ricans should import 85% of their food, this on an archipelago with some of the most fertile soil in the world. God didn't decide that Puerto Rico should get 90% of its energy from imported fossil fuels on islands bathed in sun, lashed by winds, surrounded by wave, enough to provide clean, renewable energy to spare. That was the fatal logic of colonialism and building in systems of dependency and treating Puerto Rico like a captive market and islands to extract labor and wealth for centuries. None of these superstorms are natural either. The reason why we're seeing these records shattered again and again is that the oceans are warming and the tides are higher. It's the fault of governments protecting the interests of fossil fuel companies and agribusiness companies that pay for their campaigns. Not a storm, but a storm supercharged by climate change, slamming into societies deliberately weakened by relentless economic austerity layered on top of centuries of colonial extraction, with the relief effort overseen by a government that doesn't even try to disguise its white supremacy. If it were incompetence, there would be some effort to fix the underlying failures, to rebuild the public sphere, design a food and energy system that actually served Puerto Rico. But we have seen the exact opposite. We have seen nothing but more disaster capitalism, using the trauma of the storm to push massive cuts to education, push a wave of home foreclosures, to shut hundreds of schools, and to sell off Puerto Rico's most valuable public assets. And just as Trump denies the reality of so many Puerto Rican deaths, of thousands of Puerto Rican deaths, so does he deny the reality of climate change so that he can push through dozens of toxic laws that make the problem so much worse. This is the official response to this catastrophe, doing everything possible to make sure that it happens again and again. So we're supporting a very, very different kind of transition, and we've heard a lot about that today, supporting dozens of organizations in Puerto Rico that have come together to articulate a different vision for the island. And that begins with erasing an illegal and illegitimate debt. Only when the debt is addressed, only when the junta is gone, will there be political space to redesign the food, energy, housing, and transportation systems so that they're able to serve the Puerto Rican people. Today, I'm reminded of the words of Dalma Cartagena, one of the great leaders of Puerto Rico's agroecology movement. She said, "Maria hit us hard, but it made our convictions stronger. The era of planned misery and designed dependence must end. It is time to plan for joy and design for liberation, so that when the next storm comes, and it will, the winds will roar, and the trees will bend, but Puerto Rico will show the world that it can never be broken." Thank you.
I just want to thank all of the folks from Our Power PR NYC,
all of our elders who were out in all kinds of weather, putting up flyers, going into buildings, all of our young people that were going into barbershops, all of the street associations that are here today. These are the people who have been struggling for generations. These are the people, the elders who fought against the bombing of Vieques, the folks that fought for Oscar Lopez, literally the people who are part of the Puerto Rican diaspora who have been holding it down for a minute for that island to be free. And so I want you to show your gratitude for people who did not get paid, that did this out of love for their people, out of love for community, and out of love for Puerto Rico. So with that, I want to bring back on my co-MC, Caridad La Bruja de la Luz.
A round of applause for Elizabeth, please. Working tirelessly. I'm going to do a poem. How many people saw West Side Story? So there's a part I always wanted to play Anita, but there was a song I couldn't sing. And the one that she sang was I Like to Live in America. I was like, I can't do that, those words. I can't say those words. But I would say it if I could sing it this way. Puerto Rico, such sad emotion, overrun by colonization. Always the government showing, even by paper towel throwing, that the hatred's growing and the displaced screaming. I'd like to try independence. You're supposed to say, I know you do. If we don't fight, just forget it. I'd like to be in America with policies in America, not run by greed in America, paradise free from America. But we all know we have no rights. Fought every war that they'd go fight. Autonomy sounds just so extreme, but statehood is only a pipe dream. They don't tell the truth in America. We have been duped by America. Yanked from the roots in America. We've come to roost in America. Citizenship has been so great. As long as you're born with a white face. At least the salons keep us content. If you wear out your afro, it's unkempt. Terrible fight in America, treated with spite in America, read our last rights in America, left without lights in America. They say we were given a free ride. Response to Maria was genocide. Every injustice we excuse. Maybe we'll visit on boat cruise. Fed only lies in America. Live on Fox 5 in America. Screwed on both sides in America. But Brujas will rise in America. The rent in the city is far gone. Can't even afford it in San Juan. Bye-bye. Haven't gone home for a whole year. Hey, but we can't just visit as sightseers. Let's take our island back, ladies and gentlemen.
So I'm running to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in Union Square. What brings you here?
You know, I'm here. I come from a grassroots movement, and I'm coming right back to grassroots movements to really guide the light forward in the recovery for Puerto Rico. Today is the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria making landfall on the island. And we still have yet to have full justice for those families there, an equal recovery, a just transition. And we can't afford to allow the worst humanitarian crisis in modern American history to go on without full acknowledgement, because we really risk our future. If we don't acknowledge and rebuild from this storm, and correct everything that's happened from the storm, then we will continue to allow these disasters to strike families throughout the United States.
Alexandria, let me ask you this. Your point of distinction from other candidates, your inspiration to run, but what do you bring to this process as opposed to the other candidates, indeed the candidate that you defeated? Who are you? What's your underlying ideology of the elections?
Well, I think so much of our campaign and our race comes down to the fact that I don't accept any corporate money or any money from corporate PACs or special interests. Right. And that at the core informs and gives us the ability to talk about issues with a frankness that is so directly connected to our constituency that we're able to kind of break a lot of taboos. When we talk about the colonial status of Puerto Rico, when we talk about climate change, when we talk about housing, healthcare, education, student loans, the predatory behaviors of certain Wall Street actors. And that at its core will, I think, allow us and makes us advocate for issues on a level that many other candidates cannot.
Okay, one of the speakers mentioned not only that the debt should be forgiven, but that reparations be paid for so many years of colonialism. What's your position on that?
Well, I do believe in Puerto Rican debt forgiveness. In fact, a very large percentage of Puerto Rican debt is speculated to be illegal. A lot of the debt was issued in illegal forms. But also when it comes to reparations, I support the establishment of an investigatory committee on reparations that's already been proposed, I believe. I think that having the exploration of that with respect to Puerto Rico is completely legitimate.
Well, buena suerte, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Thank you for speaking with us.
And good luck in your
campaign.
Thank you.
David Galarza, this has been a long day for you. Your thoughts on this anniversary of the hurricane in conjunction with the advent of the junta on the island of Puerto Rico?
Well, thank you, Mimi. Thank you, Ken, for being here and for continuing to cover the events in Puerto Rico. So like you said, at 6:15 this morning in front of 26 Federal Plaza, we gathered with some activists and folks, including Juan Cartagena from Latino Justice PRODEF, and other Puerto Ricans and other allies uniting with us in the struggle to make sure that people don't forget that these are not just numbers we're talking about. These are people that we lost during Maria and now obviously after. People say 3,000, other people say 4,000. The reality is that we'll never know the exact number of people that died. These are babies that died, mothers and fathers who died, seniors who died. These are people that were buried in their backyards. These are people that were drowned, weren't allowed access to medicines and so forth and so on. So today is a sad, frustrating moment for many Boricuas here and obviously on the island. But it's also a day to celebrate the resilience of our people, both on the island and those living in exile here in the United States and elsewhere. Because we've come together in these last 12 months and shown the world. We've got organizations like the Comedores Sociales and we have Taller Salud and we have Casa Pueblo that I work closely with in the mountains. And they're the ones that are showing that another Puerto Rico is possible. And that's why I continue to tell people to support those on-the-ground organizations because they're the ones that really need the assistance and they're the ones that are really making sure that every cent is properly spent on doing the kinds of things that need to be done for Puerto Rico. So today was a day that made us reflect a lot on those we lost, but it's also a day that made us plan and start really looking forward to a Puerto Rico that's energy independent, that has food sovereignty, and that has kicked out all these multinationals like the Walmarts, the Burger Kings, and the McDonald's. that are taking money and resources out of Puerto Rico. There's more Walmarts and Walgreens and other big box stores in Puerto Rico per capita than any place on the planet. That money doesn't circulate in Puerto Rico. That money goes back to Bentonville and wherever the other headquarters for the other corporations are. So it's important for us, in order to rebuild Puerto Rico and have a just rebuild, to support those small businesses in Puerto Rico, those mom and pops, those restaurants, the clinics and the hospitals that are owned by the government, by the people. We got to stop the privatization of our public schools, of our agencies, of PREPA, the utilities. We got to do everything within our power to make sure that that doesn't happen, because we saw what happened in New Orleans, what's happened in places like Argentina and Greece, and we need to continue to support our brothers and sisters in the labor movement, especially the independent labor unions in Puerto Rico that are fighting that good fight.
Obviously, the debt has to be forgiven. And you mentioned some of the agenda that you wanted to see done in terms of ecology, and you mentioned some of the organizations. Could you flesh that out? What is the way forward?
Well, there's an organization right now that's calling for an audit of the debt. A major cry that's been made right now is to cancel the debt altogether. It's an illegal debt. It's a debt that basically is a tantamount to, like, exorbitant rates, like payday loans that are going to be due in the next 20, 30, 40 years at exorbitant 400, 500% interest. Debts that were not incurred by the people of Puerto Rico. Debts that were incurred by corrupt government administrations. This is a debt that the junta is trying to get paid with the federal funds that should be going to the people of Puerto Rico, and they're trying to siphon that money and redirect it to get to pay back these funds and these hedge fund vultures. So we got to be vigilant about that, that we can't allow any cent to be sent to these hedge fund vultures. We got to make sure that the people get paid first, that those pensions are fulfilled, and that continue to rally around the folks that are also auditing the debt, because if we audit that debt, we'll see where that debt really originate. We'll see who the players are behind that debt. And there's obviously an effort to undermine that on the part of the local government and the hedge fund vultures, because we know that that's a farce and it's an illegal debt.
Well, just on two of the points, though, that I think you mentioned, what about sustainable agriculture and what about clean energy?
We need food justice and food sovereignty, and we need energy independence. Like Naomi Klein so eloquently said, we have the sun shining on us every single day. We've got wind power. We've got waves surrounding our island. There's absolutely no reason why Puerto Rico cannot become the centerpiece for sustainability and solar energy and renewable energies. And as a matter of fact, today Casa Pueblo announced a collaboration with Google Earth where they're targeting at least 4 to 5 urban pockets in Puerto Rico right now. And they're zeroing in on the rooftops for buildings and organizations to see what the viability is for solar panel usage. People start thinking about solar energy in that way, that it's possible, and this is what it would mean in terms of energy production through solar energy use. Then they'll start really seeing a future is possible without combustibles, without energy, without fossil fuels and gas and dirty oil. We know that right now also there's an attempt by the guy who tried to launch the gasoducto, Fortuño, who's a right-winger, Tea Party bagger, and so forth, to try to resurrect this gas tube that was totally a corrupt plan and project to begin with. They just came out with a book, Casa Pueblo, on how we defeated that pipeline. But they're once again lobbying the same energy interests to try to do this once again, and we can't allow that to happen. We can do it another way. And there's so many that are showing us, like Casa Pueblo and all these other companies, that nonprofits that are doing it the right way. You know, we want green energy, but we also don't want privatized green energy. We don't want green capitalists, so to speak, to come in there and call the shots. We need for this to also be generated by the community, these ideas and this power to also be community-owned and operated.
And as we stand here, there's this fabulous projection on the building across the street. Just Recovery for Puerto Rico, noted Colonialism Fund Frontline Solutions. Ah, right? The remnant of Occupy when you're projecting these things.
PR.
So yes. With that, to just punctuate this, how do people get in touch with any of the organizations or efforts that you've talked to us about so that we can continue our work and build greater support? But certainly the resilience and the accomplishment of a nation that will throw off colonialism yet.
First and foremost, one of the organizations I work closely with is Casa Pueblo. So that would be casapueblo.org, and that's Casa, C-A-S-A, Pueblo, P-U-E-B-L-O. Please go there. You'll see what they've been doing these past, not just year, but these past 38 years. They also fought and won a battle against two multinational mining companies. A group that's on the ground right today was also launched a network of what they call CAMs, the Centros de Apoyo Mutuo, Centers for Mutual Aid, around the island. These are the organizations, mostly young people, that sprang up right after Maria and started feeding people, started providing all kinds of services, acupuncture, healthcare, and so forth, to the people in Puerto Rico. So today they just launched a website. If you want to go to Comedores Sociales de Puerto Rico on Facebook, you can also get the link to this organization. And that's cdpecpr.org. That's cdpecpr.org. Comedores Sociales de Puerto Rico, another phenomenal organization in terms of self-sustainability and autogestión, you know, that we can do this on our own. But so those are the two prime organizations that I've been working closely with that I would encourage people to support. And also on Facebook, a group here in New York that's been doing a lot of work, anti-colonial work, call to action on Puerto Rico. So I would encourage people to also look us up on Facebook and attend the many events that we coordinate throughout the year.
Gracias por todo. Thank you for the work you do. And I just want to read off some of the slogans that are fantastic.
Our power PRNYC. Remember that.
Absolutely.
Our power PRNYC. Follow the hashtag. Those are the people that are involved with this coalition. Hashtag our power PR.NYC. Please follow that hashtag for future events and activities. This is a coalition of groups that came together from all sectors, from the Taino Confederation, to folks that do the art, you know, artists here, like Bombayo, Mariposa, a whole slew of folks, Naomi Klein, Rosa Clemente, a whole bunch of folks that came out here from all over the place, from the diaspora and beyond, to be presente for Puerto Rico on this day. It's a beautiful day for our people, because although, like we say in the labor movement, mourn the dead, but we're going to fight like hell for the living.
And there have been a lot of labor unions involved in the recovery.
That's right. Including, I have to give a shout out to the nurses, because they've been phenomenal. Not just in not only supporting, but also in sending brigades of nurses out there to do the good work of healing the people.
They've been fantastic. You've been fantastic. Thank you. And I want to read off. Let's start with Repeal the Jones Act. I love it. Let's see. What's the next one that's coming up? And these are flashed on all the buildings of Union Square. Our Power, PRNYC. Just Recovery for Puerto Rico. Drop the Debt, Puerto Rico. Decolonize Puerto Rico Now. Colonialism plus austerity plus militarism equal Puerto Rico in crisis. Puerto Rico no se vende. And we're going to end our stint at this rally, except to say Hurricane Maria, 4,645 plus dead. We need people-powered recovery. So, Ken, this has been a fantastic rally.
It certainly was. Not only the number of people that showed up here, but the enthusiasm. Movement is growing, and that is what we need. And he needs to keep on going and get rid of this domination of Puerto Rico by the U.S., which caused all this problem.
No to colonialism, yes to people power. It's here, it's lovely, it's inspired. And we've all got a responsibility as the colonizers to lend our voices and lend our power to the struggle to decolonize Puerto Rico, drop the debt, abolish the Jones Act, support Puerto Rico Libre.
And reparations.
And reparations for all the oppressed people.
And you've been listening to a special on Puerto Rico, Island of Resistance, Island of Resilience, and Island that will fight against colonialism. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and that was a great demonstration, a sincerely great demonstration.
Always agitate, educate, organize,
and mobilize.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Hi, I'm Drew. I talk with fellow outcaster Lucas about LGBTQ youth suicide and education.
Indian culture is also pretty gay. But gay culture is really Indian.
Sing, sing, sing that Looney Tune.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Human rights conferees evade Lebanese security shutdown. Queer youth demand adult action to stop bullying and suicide, and we focus on star of songs and screen, Jennifer Cordae. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 6th, 2018. Lebanese security forces invaded a regional queer rights conference at a Beirut hotel this week after a conservative Muslim fringe group complained that it was promoting homosexuality and drug use. They demanded the cancellation of the rest of the conference and the arrest of its organizers, calling the planned four-day event an incitement to immorality. What's come to be known as NEDWA, the Northeastern Dordogne Women's Association, is an annual conference that's been organized by the Arab Foundation for Freedom and Equality, or AFE, since 2013. It attracted more than 100 activists from the Arabic-speaking Middle East and North Africa region this year to workshops focusing on human rights and featuring presentations by queer rights leaders. Security officers temporarily detained AFE Executive Director Georges Azzi, demanding that he sign a pledge to shut down the rest of the conference and cease any further activities related to it. When he refused, security officers told the hotel that they were shutting the conference down. Officers also gathered the names, personal details, and passport copies of all of those in attendance, alarming several participants from repressive regimes in countries like Egypt and Iraq, who feared persecution, arrest, or worse when they returned home.
After being counseled by AFE lawyers and lawyers from one of the country's leading queer rights advocacy groups, HELEM, Azzi signed an agreement with the security forces promising not to organize an LGBTQ meeting at the hotel the next day. But, as attendee Outright International's Jessica Stern noted in her personal account of the events, he said nothing about other days or venues. Azzi found another hotel that was willing to take them in, and the rest of the conference was held without incident, although some activists who were shaken by the security forces' experience decided to leave before its conclusion. Lebanese LGBTQ people have been on a rights roller coaster this year. An appeals court ruled in July that the country's penal code section that punishes sexual acts that contradict the laws of nature does not specifically outlaw homosexuality and acquitted 9 people who had been prosecuted for having consensual adult gay sex. But just a month earlier, the organizer of Beirut's annual Pride Festival was threatened with arrest on charges of immorality if the event went forward, forcing him to cancel everything. Azzi held a defiant press conference as the dust was settling from this year's stressful NEDWA gathering. "These kind of attacks are expected, and there is no activism without risks," he said. "But we need to be more prepared, stay united, and help each other to stand up and continue the fight."
Switzerland's National Council voted this week to punish homophobic and transphobic discrimination with up to 3 years in prison. The 118-60 vote puts anti-queer hate on par with the country's laws against bias based on race, national origin, or religion. The bill, sponsored by Swiss Socialist Party council member Matthias Renard, still requires approval by the Council of States, but LGBTQ rights groups cheered the lopsided vote in the lower house. Marriage equality remains elusive in Switzerland, and Renard says that's his next goal. Unlike many of its European neighbors, queer Swiss couples have only been able to enter into less-than-equal civil partnerships since 2007, which deny them tax benefits similar to those given to married heterosexual couples, as well as adoption rights and access to welfare and fertility services, among other perks. The Council of States will vote on Renard's queer anti-bias proposal in December. Following the National Council vote, the notably heterosexual lawmaker told reporters that homophobia is not an opinion, it's a crime.
The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights emphatically told representatives of the Chilean government during a meeting in Boulder, Colorado this week that it must move forward with marriage equality, not only to comply with an agreement signed in 2016 between the country's leading queer rights group and the government of former President Michelle Bachelet, but also to comply with the January 2018 Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruling that ordered signatory nations to the American Convention on Human Rights to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Representatives of conservative Chilean President Sebastián Piñera claimed that his government had promoted marriage equality, thereby complying with the settlement agreement. Rolando Jiménez was among several leading queer activists to deride that assertion as a complete fallacy. "They have not lifted a finger in favor of this law," he said, "and, worse still, their officials have spoken out against equal marriage." A commission representative will moderate a new meeting of the working group sometime soon in Chile, which was established when representatives of the government and queer activists hammered out the marriage equality settlement agreement in 2016. The Bachelet government's two-year-old marriage equality bill remains stalled in Congress, where it is now said to have majority support.
Meanwhile, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump continues to reverse LGBTQ advances made during the tenure of Barack Obama. In a statement published on its website this week, the State Department warned that effective immediately, U.S. embassies and consulates will adjudicate visa applications that are based on a same-sex marriage in the same way that we adjudicate applications for opposite-gender spouses. The new directive also applies to staff at the United Nations, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. In practical terms, even though the policy ostensibly puts same-gender couples on the same footing as heterosexual couples, U.S.-based queer employees of international organizations and foreign missions who are not legally married to their partners must now do so or face not being able to live together. Foreign Policy magazine counted at least 10 partnered queer employees at the New York headquarters of the UN alone who will be affected. Only 25 of the 193 member states of the UN have opened civil marriage to same-gender couples. Private consensual adult same-gender sex is against the law in some 70 countries. So a queer staff member from one of those countries working at a global organization or foreign mission in the U.S. or at a U.S. embassy or consulate must now choose between the person they love or potential persecution at home for getting married, a dilemma not faced by heterosexual couples. David Pressman served as U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Security Council for Special Political Affairs under President Barack Obama. He told NBC News that if that's how you advance equality between same-sex and opposite-sex partners, then we have an enormous problem on our hands. Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, identified by the well-respected Southern Poverty Law Center as an anti-queer hate group, predictably applauded the move. "Thank goodness for the Trump administration," he said in a blog posting, "which has proven time and time again that its focus is religious freedom and human rights for everyone, not special rights for a select few."
But finally, three Christian pastors in Rumford, Maine, were unable to ban the display of queer-positive books during the local public library's end-of-September observance of the American Library Association's annual Banned Books Week. Their letter to the local library's Board of Trustees complained that including LGBTQ-themed books in the banned books display promoted homosexuality. Rumford is a small town in western Maine with about 5,000 residents. LGBTQ-themed books have dominated the American Library Association's annual list of the country's top 10 banned books for the past several years. and Tango Makes Three, the children's book about a real-life male penguin couple at New York's Central Park Zoo who adopt an abandoned egg to raise as their own, is one of the perennial top 10 entries, as is the lesbian-themed classic The Color Purple. Library employee Marianne Fournier defended the inclusive display during a public meeting of the library trustees. She said the controversy had forced her to come out. "I've been coming to this library just about every day since I was 5 years old," she said, "and now I work here." After pointing out that the pastor's letter didn't object to the banned book's display of 50 Shades of Grey, which contains scenes of heterosexual sadomasochism, Fournier said, "I don't want to hide. I hid for a long time, and now I'm wondering what my father's going to think when I go home." "And now you want me to hide the LGBTQ books that are like Bibles to some of these children," she said, pointing out that they're frequently stolen by some of these LGBTQ teens because they don't want their parents to know they're checking them out. Several dozen people who had crammed into the public meeting because it would be dealing with the pastor's published pronouncements loudly cheered her remarks. In the end, the Rumford Public Library Board of Trustees voted unanimously to maintain the queer-inclusive Banned Books Week display.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending October 6th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the always evolving thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
This just in, Romania's referendum to redefine marriage in the Constitution as between one man and one woman has failed due to low voter turnout. 30% of registered voters were needed to make the result valid, but only 20% showed up at the polls. LGBTQ and human rights activists campaigning against the constitutional amendment had urged a boycott of the referendum. Their efforts apparently worked. Even though civil marriage is still not open to lesbian and gay couples in Romania, the amendment would have effectively put any future legal recognition of those relationships out of reach.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
I liked beer. I still like beer. Had beers. Have some beers. One beer. Drink beer. Drinks beer. Drank beer. And drinking beer.
Beer, beer, beer. Beer, beer, beer. Beer, beer, beer. Beer, beer, beer. Beer, beer, beer. Beer, beer, beer. Beer, 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 beer.
I like beer. I don't know if you do.
Okay.
You like beer, Senator?
On August 23, 2018, Jamel Miles killed himself. He was 9 years old and had come out as gay a few days before committing suicide.
Queer youth tell us how to make it get better later in the program. The revival of the beloved and biting sitcom Murphy Brown has brought a new queer star to U.S. network television. Nick Dodani made his late-night stand-up comedy debut last week on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert as his new show was premiering. He joked about his Indian heritage and being a gay man.
It's tough being Indian and gay because Indian culture is still pretty homophobic, which is weird to me because Indian culture is also pretty gay. Just last year, Bollywood released 1,100 movies, almost every single one of them. A musical. After I wrote that joke, I had the strange realization that not only is Indian culture really gay, but gay culture is really Indian. You have bright colors and rainbows everywhere. People worshiping goddesses everywhere. The thing about gay culture that bugs me the most is that as a gay man, you're expected to label yourself, you know? You have bears who are the big, burly gay man. You have twinks who are the younger, slender gays. And you have otters and cubs and koalas, probably. What if we started doing that to straight guys? You'd have the weasel. That's the guy that pretends to respect women in order to get laid. And then you'd have the, well, I guess that's it. The hardest thing about being gay by far is coming out to your parents. There's nothing more nerve-wracking than that. And In Indian culture, there's a tradition where parents arrange their kids' marriages. My parents had an arranged marriage. I thought the one benefit of coming out to my mother would be that she wouldn't push that on me anymore. But she is a dedicated woman. Just last week, she posted an ad on Craigslist that read, "My son, 24 years old, Indian, gay, works in entertainment, seeks Indian lesbian facing similar family pressure."
Gay Indian comedian Nick Dadani of Murphy Brown displayed his stand-up skills on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh?
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out.
Corday will make your heart beat faster, but first...
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
Several years ago, a rash of highly publicized queer teen suicides brought tons of media coverage to the issue. Even though the headlines have been quiet, the horrifying situation continues, and the queer youth broadcasters of Outcasting Overtime want to see the problem addressed now.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, public radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Dhruv, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, I talk with fellow Outcaster Lucas about LGBTQ youth suicide and education, focusing on the tragic story of a 9-year-old boy who took his own life. On August 23, 2018, Jamel Miles killed himself. He was 9 years old and had come out as gay a few days before committing suicide. The first person he came out to was his mom, and she affirmed her love for him. He proceeded to come out to his classmates, who bullied him relentlessly. He committed suicide just 4 days after coming back to school and telling his classmates that he was gay. This bullying was nothing new. His mother had been in contact with the school's administration in the past about bullying that he had experienced. This all happened in Colorado, a fairly liberal state, and yet the message that the children carry with them is that being gay is inherently bad. Schools and the government do not do nearly enough to make sure that LGBTQ children are accepted and not bullied. A possible reason for this ingrained lack of knowledge about LGBTQ people is media balancing. The media often bring in so-called family organizations, which are primarily anti-LGBTQ, in order to provide a viewpoint to balance coverage of LGBTQ issues. Some of these family groups have been designated as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has a long and distinguished history of identifying hate groups. The issue is that these anti-LGBTQ groups spread misinformation that has no basis in fact. This balancing is the same as bringing a member of the KKK onto a talk show to oppose a black civil rights activist. They provide no valid viewpoints and only serve to convolute the conversation surrounding LGBTQ people. This can ultimately lead to children being taught that homosexuality is negative if they know what it is at all. On top of that, the message being sent out by influential people is often negative. For example, the Office of the President should be a beacon to guide the nation in all affairs, especially ethical ones. But Donald Trump serves as a beacon for all those who hold homophobic beliefs, not only accepting but also encouraging the message that the LGBTQ community is different and should be excluded. His administration has dismantled supports to provide equal health care to LGBTQ people and has opposed supporting LGBTQ students. Education and messaging that being gay is not something negative are necessary for a better tomorrow, but this is not usually taught in schools or at all. Lucas, would you like to tell us about your experience with LGBTQ youth in school?
Yes, I would love to. I went to elementary school in California, and for the most part, I would say we are a relatively homogeneous and caring and loving group. But somewhere through elementary school, there was this one kid that was different. We weren't sure what was different about him, but he was definitely not the same as everyone else. And people started making fun of him and bullying him. And eventually, someone learned the word gay and started calling him the word gay. And throughout this whole period, we had learned nothing from the teachers or the administration about the LGBTQ community or what the word gay meant. In general, we just assumed it meant something bad, and soon the whole grade had picked up on it. We weren't only calling that kid gay, but if something was bad, we'd call, like, that tree is gay, which just meant that tree is bad. I eventually found out what the word gay and just more about the LGBTQ community, not from the school, but from my mom when I went home. She explained that it's just someone that likes someone from the same gender. And at that point, the negative seed that had been growing and the connotation that had been placed with that word was extinguished. But before that, it seemed like something natural that was just evil. Even after this point, many kids at my school still use this word as something that's negative, or evil in this case. And throughout this whole period, the administration never taught us anything. And this all happened in California, which is, of course, also a very liberal state. We can only imagine how much worse it is in states with worse representation of LGBTQ people in the media and by their local government. This cannot be the norm for another generation of LGBTQ youth, or, in fact, for any youth. This lack of education and bad representation of LGBTQ people is not just an inconvenience, it is killing the LGBTQ youth of today. Teen suicide and LGBTQ suicide is preventable. If you feel the need to talk to anyone, the Trevor Project has trained counselors on a safe and judgment-free hotline at any time. Call 1-866-488-7386 or contact them online at thetrevorproject.org.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
The LGBTQ indie music scene is full of well-kept secrets. Even an aficionado like Steve Sims can be surprised, as he is in his latest This Way Out music focus.
Oh, 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 listen to the music. Oh, 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 listen to the music. Oh, 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 listen to the music.
Much of my life is immersed in music. From my daily work, weekly productions, and general leisure time, music is always in the forefront, or at least in the background. Yet every day, I'm reminded of how expansive music is, and how little I know.
Drink, I won't smoke, I won't cheat and steal. So please, Mrs. Inigilist, don't leave me hanging here.
That's Jennifer Cordae, or just Cordae. And no, I'm not launching the holiday season just yet. Cordae's song Mr. St. Nick is an example of how limited what I know about music can be. That upbeat Christmas song from Cordae was released in 1991. But until recently, that's all I associated the name Cordae with. Then I saw a posting that the music video of her song Heartbeat would be screening at the Indianapolis LGBTQ Film Festival being held November 9th through 11th. Envy Records calls Heartbeat a compelling journey through heartbreak and heartache. Seeing the posting got me thinking about Cordae and what else I might not know. I learned her song Pie was included on the soundtrack for the MTV series Undressed, which follows the relationship of young people in the Los Angeles area. Cordae also wrote the soundtrack for Nicole Kahn's 2010 film, Alina Undone, about a romance between a mother and pastor's wife and a well-known lesbian writer. In a movie review of Alina Undone by William Eamon Workman, he wrote that the music is magnificently done, particularly Jennifer Cordae's Coming Undone.
Strip off the ends of me, where I'm callous. Come on, look inside.
Cordae's anthemic, sexy drinking song, Second Shot, is the title track of the series Second Shot, and can also be heard in the movie At Your Own Risk, which played opening night last April at the 2018 Women in Action Film Festival.
Rip my whistle. Just one more time. Give me one more shot.
Jennifer Cordae has over 5 award-winning studio albums and 20 music awards, and her video for Dragonfire is setting fire to film festival screens across the country. Cordae played cello in her college chamber orchestra, was a substitute teacher, and then taught drama and English at Paramount High School in Paramount, California, where she acted as head of department and cheerleading advisor. She then transitioned to singer-songwriter-guitarist in the coffeehouse circuit. She founded Venus Envy, an organization that donates profits from compilation CDs towards the fight against breast cancer, in memory of her mother, Judy.
No one's ever got you yet. So sing, sing, sing that loony tune. Like a bird, you'll sing till you turn blue. I used to have hope you'd be saved. But now I know you're just...
This is Looney Tune, a favorite of mine off her latest album called You Can't Change My DNA, which was released September 1st. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Oh, you've gone insane.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Christopher Gall and Michelle Yeder, produced with Brian DeShazer, from Outcasters Druv and Lucas, produced by Mark Sophos, and from Steve Sims. David Brown and Jennifer Cordae performed some of the music you heard. That beer commercial music came from the classic LP A Child's Garden of Grass, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Thanks for helping keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media and wherever you get your podcasts. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WBCR, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, Plains FM, Christchurch, New Zealand, KSPC, Claremont, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Long before Scott Pruitt and his interim successor Andrew Wheeler headed the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA has been protecting the chemical industry and not the public. That's what a massive trove of over 20,000 documents indicates. Known as the Poison Papers, the documents were obtained from federal agencies, including the EPA, and chemical manufacturers through Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits. They implicate not only the EPA in knowingly allowing unsafe chemicals into public use, but also the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Forest Service, and the Department of Defense, as well as chemical manufacturers like Dow, Monsanto, DuPont, and Union Carbide. The Poison Papers are co-published by the Bioscience Research Project, and I'm joined by its executive director, Jonathan Latham, himself a scientist. Jonathan, let's begin with this astounding fact. The EPA has a database of some 85,000 chemicals that have been manufactured or processed in the United States, but less than 300 have been subjected to rigorous testing and only 5 have been banned. How is that even possible?
I would say that the 300 that you mentioned have not actually been subjected to rigorous testing. So we have a presumption that chemicals go on the market, right? That is the default. And so, you know, what we'll discuss later in this is that that presumption is part of so much part of the system that essentially, the system can't resist producing chemicals and having them go on the market. So, you know, it seems incredible. It is incredible that we should have, because many of these chemicals are in our bodies, for example. And so it is an astounding thing, you know, that we really need to flag up. But there are many other aspects to this problem that hopefully we can talk about today.
So you're saying that even of this mere
300, even those aren't rigorously tested. So in effect, you're saying that there are something like 85,000 chemicals on the market, and basically none of them have been tested, or almost none of them have been tested in a way that would yield the impact on human health.
Yeah. I mean, there's a deep complicity of the regulatory system to allow chemicals onto the market. And, you know, what I will argue is, you know, even if you had a competent and not corrupt regulator, you would basically have a very hard time actually sorting chemicals that were safe from chemicals that are not safe. Because at the end of the day, you have to establish, if you want to do it properly, you have to establish safety in terms of, you know, neurological effects, in terms of reproductive effects, in terms of effects on subsequent generations, in terms of immunological effects, in terms of gut health effects and so forth. You know, the list of questions that one can ask about these chemicals and that are highly relevant to our daily lives and so forth. Like, for example, are people who are in bad health protected from these chemicals, for example? Are people who are very young or very elderly protected from these chemicals? Essentially, when you start to think about it in a scientific way, you realize that we don't ask possibly even 1% of the relevant number of questions that we would need to ask in order to effectively be protecting the public. So we end up in a very difficult place. Like, how much money are you prepared to spend to put these on the market and do the experiments that are actually sufficient to generate a chemical safety process that is functional? And then the next question also becomes, if one had in a society, and it doesn't exist anywhere in the world, but a chemical safety system in which the regulator was honest, the tests were good, would any chemicals actually pass? Because you have compounds like BPA, for example, for which there are hundreds.
Which are plastics.
Yes, BPA, thank you. BPA is a plastic. And that compound has been found in the scientific literature to have, you know, heart effects, to have neurological effects, to have reproductive effects. And this is just one chemical. And so we can imagine that if we actually put the same amount of research into other chemicals, we would come up with similar answers. And the question is, ultimately, is biological life compatible with synthetic chemicals that are long-lasting in the environment and that we're exposed to at high levels? Because the evidence from our ecosystems is that it's not compatible.
Putting aside the interweaving aspects of the implications of synthetic chemicals on our bodies, on the ecosystems that we are part of, you are suggesting, though, that the EPA is negligent in even the most sort of rudimentary attempts at testing the chemicals that are on the market. And so I want to ask you, in what way does the EPA operate, and what allows for there to be a public perception that the EPA is there as the guardian of our health, the watchdog to make sure that toxic chemicals are not allowed onto the market, and yet, in fact, we're surrounded by all sorts of chemicals, and the EPA has been complicit in it.
Mm. So this is the big question here. So what we have observed from the poison papers is that, in the first place, EPA, one of its major functions is to evaluate chemicals before they come onto the market. The current system is that there is a set of independent chemical testing labs, so-called independent, because I don't really believe they are meaningfully independent, independent chemical testing labs that do the rat experiments, the rubbing in the eyes and the skin toxicity and the long-term chronic toxicity test. So these labs do those tests. Then they pass on usually summaries to the applicant, who is the company, and then the company passes that on to the EPA. So you have a long paper trail before the thing gets to the EPA. And what EPA has seen numerous times over the course of its history and emanating from many different versions and iterations of these labs is that the tests are very often fraudulent and faulty. And even if they're simply faulty, What EPA is doing is allowing companies to withhold information about those tests. So, for example, they'll be missing experiments. Like, why did, you know, they've agreed. The way the system is set up is a protocol is agreed to test a specific compound, and then what the companies are submitting, what the applicant's submitting, is a violated protocol. And the protocol has missing lungs, missing livers, missing animals, missing all kinds of stuff. And so the obvious question becomes, well, are these things missing because the company is incompetent, right? Or is it missing because actually there was evidence of harm and they didn't wish to submit it? But either way, the EPA should not be accepting this data. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day whether they're incompetent or whether they're fraudulent. So you see this evidence of all these submissions going to the EPA, which are either fraudulent or faulty. And the EPA does nothing about it, right? So the question becomes, why does the EPA do nothing about it? Like, what kind of regulatory agency behaves in that way? So I want to put that together with another piece of information. When EPA receives these submissions, quite often there is still some evidence of toxicity, like chronic toxicity or carcinogenicity, like elevated levels of tumors in treatment groups and so on and so forth, often in dramatic ways. And what the EPA does is they treat the evidence of harm, say the elevated tumors or the novel chronic toxicity or the early deaths of animals, as if they were aberrations. And they take this because their presumption, as I said earlier, their presumption is, seems to be, that all chemicals are safe. And if there is evidence of unsafety, they treat it as if it's some kind of, you know, a mistake has been made. So that's what I mean by an aberration. So they treat it in that way. And so they basically find ways in which to minimize or reduce or wash away or essentially ignore that data. So you see them using all these pseudoscientific arguments. So, for example, they will look at the controls, and they will say, "Well, in the past, we've had controls that showed higher levels than these controls, and if those controls have been used, that would basically eliminate the evidence that we have in front of us that there's elevated toxicity in the treatment group." So, the use of historical controls, it's called, is commonplace in regulatory science. The use of those controls is entirely unscientific, right? The whole point of a control is you do it at the same time in the same place as the animals with the same batch of animals under the same temperature conditions because you know, what's often found is that controls differ over time and space and so forth. So this has no scientific basis, using these historical controls. Or they will take, for example, they'll find data in which they have elevated levels of cancer in, say, the male rats, but not in the female rats. And they will look at that elevated levels, those elevated levels in the male rats, and they'll say, well, that's not consistent with the female rats. Presumably, that's because it resulted from some aberration. And so you see these arguments being made by the evaluators. And so what you're perceiving is a whole set of basically pseudoscientific arguments being used to minimize and disappear this evidence of harm. And you see, what you see is the iterations of this process. So imagine that the tested chemical has all these different evidences of harm, you know, elevated levels of different kinds of tumors in different tissues and all this data that's quite hard to explain away if you looked at it in face value. What happens is some of it gets removed at the first level of evaluation. And then, for example, somebody will say, well, these elevated levels of cancers in the original tissues, maybe that's because the original pathologist was you know, not doing a good job. So we'll go look at those elevated levels of the tumors in the animals. We'll look at the slides again, and lo and behold, somebody will say, well, these ones, well, maybe they weren't cancers after all. Maybe they were just warts, or they were just non-malignant bumps, and so on and so forth. And so they'll go through this process until eventually at the nth level of study, the final report is written in which it basically says there's no evidence of any harm. And what's interesting about this is that these arguments are very compartmentalized. So you know, one individual evaluator at EPA will not necessarily know that everybody else has been doing this too, right? So they will have a small amount of evidence of harm in front of them, and they'll go kind of, you know, I don't really believe this, do you know what I mean? But they won't see the whole picture. So you see this process going on, and it's totally inconsistent with the precautionary principle, with science, in fact. But nevertheless, they're doing it. And they're all doing it, and they're doing it in different ways, and they're finding different arguments. And I haven't gone anywhere near exhausting the number of different arguments that they use. And the sensation that you get is that any argument will do at the end of the day. And the question then becomes, why is the agency doing this? Why would an agency whose sole job is to protect the public do that? And the answer is that you have to think about the EPA's position. Political position in Washington, D.C. So imagine that you are a junior person and you work at the EPA and you find all this evidence of carcinogenicity in the Monsanto's newest product or some company, big company's newest product, of which there, you know, there's all this hullabaloo about how exciting this insecticide will be or how exciting this pesticide will be. And you are basically standing in the way of a huge multinational corporation and massive profits for them. And you can't make that decision yourself. You have to pass it on to your boss. And your boss will pass it on to their boss. And their boss will pass it on to their boss. Because this is not something that even can be done at the level of, you know, senior EPA management. Basically, well, that decision will ultimately go to the head of the EPA and then to the president. And the president is not an environmentalist, right? The president is worried about the next election. They're worried about their chemical industry donors. They're worried about the economy. They're worried about all these things that an EPA decision to ban a $1 billion product is going to get in the way of all of those things. And so the EPA basically has to make a decision as an agency. Are we going to back this, you know, taking down this $1 billion product of a multi-$1 billion organization or not? And the EPA is never going to do that because it has no allies in Washington. There's nobody to support it. It's going to be against all these huge players. So essentially what the agency has to do is avoid ways of confronting these massive industries. And this is the way they do it, right? So everybody in the agency is burying little bits of the data, and incrementally it's all washed away so that things that have these humongous toxicities sometimes are basically billed as safe at the end of the day.
That's the voice of Executive Director of the Bioscience Resource Project, Jonathan Latham, which has co-published the Poison Papers. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we're talking about what those papers indicate about the very tight relationship between state regulators and the chemical industry. So let me ask you more about the way the EPA operates, and we'll talk as we go on about the political motivations for the EPA, which the Poison Papers, interestingly enough, also reveal the complicity of other state regulators in supporting the chemical industry even before the founding of the EPA in 1970. But in the 1970s, there was a scandal involving the Industrial Biotest Laboratories, which was a ostensibly independent laboratory that ran safety studies on hundreds of chemicals with the purpose of testing them for the Environmental Protection Agency. Mm. What was revealed about those tests, and what was the consequence of the revelations?
Yeah. So first of all, just to the point of whether that company was independent or not, this was the company's called Industrial Biotest Labs. They are billed as an independent company, but it came out in court they were owned by Nalco, which is a chemical company. And so just to set that aside for a moment. So what happened in the IBT scandal is that somebody from the FDA perceives, a guy called Adrian Gross, that what is being submitted to the FDA is fraudulent data. He makes a guess.
And this is the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, thank you. And so he goes down to the facility that he's getting these reports from on his own dime, basically. And he walks in the door, and the secretary tries to call the police on him. But in the meantime, he goes into the labs, and when he goes into labs, he realizes these are not scientific experiments going on here. There are rats running around on the floor. There's the sprinkler system has been left on. There's dead animals everywhere. And so he's seen enough already, right, to know what's going on. What he, you know, it confirms everything that he suspected. So it turned out that this lab, which was performing about 35% of all the chemical testing in the country at the time. So we tested glyphosate, tested atrazine, it tested 2,4-D, it tested dicamba, tested PCBs. Turns out that this lab has been submitting fraudulent data for years. And the EPA finally, you know, in investigating, there's a statement in the poison papers in some meeting minutes basically saying that, you know, as of this point, this is a year and a half into the investigation, we have not found a single application that is consistent with the original data that the company had, okay? So they have lied about every single experiment they've done. And that probably isn't all of them, but I think that probably, you know, probably that you could extrapolate that fairly confidently. Certainly EPA could reasonably do that. So they would provide, they were doing fraudulent tests. They were forging signatures. They were making up data. They had hired somebody from Monsanto to test PCBs, which are a Monsanto product, right? So you know, it's the worst of the worst. And what happens at that point is, this is not, you know, all of what I've told you is known. You don't need the poison papers to figure this out. But what's interesting about the poison papers is they show that EPA tried to cover this whole thing up. Because imagine you are EPA and you've discovered that every test, you know, just a year into your investigation, you discover that every test is fraudulent. What do you do, right? Do you basically name all the chemicals and tell the public what the issue is here? Go, you know, make a clean breast of it, as it were. And basically the public is going to say, well, I'm not going to use glyphosate. I'm not going to use atrazine. Companies, you know, there's going to be a crisis. Right, of agriculture, of public confidence in the EPA, of public confidence in the chemical industry, of public confidence in the substances themselves. So what they do is they string out their investigation for 7 years, pretending to investigate to the nth degree all these studies, which they, at an early date, had already knew that it was all fraudulent and it was all falsified. But they string it out in order to buy time. So they don't tell anyone what the chemicals are. And so they string out their investigation to buy the chemical industry time to redo the test so that when EPA finally reveals everything, and it's going to come out in court too, because, you know, people go to prison over this. When it finally comes out, the companies can say, well, we've retested everything and you don't need to worry. But the EPA was totally complicit in this. And they were totally complicit too in many of those tests are still part of the data, the literature. And the reason this part of the literature is because EPA accepted all kinds of cobbled together versions of experiments. They were even accepting experiments from this company that they would not, the company themselves, the employees would not sign.
So you're saying that chemicals that are used today, that if you were to look for the safety data on them, it comes from these fraudulent tests in the 1970s.
Yeah, some was redone, but much was not.
What was the fallout from that scandal? How did the EPA then try to, you're talking the immediate fallout in terms of prolonging the investigation period. But one of the documents that are found in the poison papers relates to a meeting that took place between the EPA and its Canadian equivalent, the Health Protection Branch. Tell us about that.
So this is where some of the information I just described comes from, that document. So the document, you know, the EPA is telling the chemical industry very accurately what it's finding. And so they're finding, you know, this is how I know that they're accepting unsigned documents. They were accepting things that were cobbled together, and they were accepting all manner of, you know, unscientific procedures as part of their process of basically trying to stick this whole house of cards back together again. And so what happened subsequently is that the EPA instituted a system called good laboratory practice, And it was supposed to be to prevent this kind of disaster from happening by generating this whole system of tick boxes and so forth. There's a very expensive certification process that you can now obtain. If you want to do chemical testing and the EPA to actually pay attention to your results, you have to go through this process. But what was really problematic about this system is not the tick boxing. The tick boxing solved nothing and, in fact, made things worse because it means that this peer-reviewed scientific literature is no longer counted by the EPA. When somebody from UCSF or some other university does a toxicological study, the EPA doesn't even look at that because those labs are not certified as GLP, good laboratory practice. So it actually made things worse by excluding the entire paid-for scientific literature done by independent academics and left the field open for commercial labs who are doing these tests as companies who are basically, they're beholden to their customer, and their main customer is the chemical industry, right? This is the root of the problem, that companies like IBT, even if they weren't owned by Nalco, they would still have as their primary customer the chemical industry. If the chemical industry perceives that some lab is being too rigorous or you know, giving their products red flags, they'll just go somewhere else, right? The business model is so obviously fraudulent and conflicted that it's hard to see how it could ever work. But that process is the fundamental problem here. And EPA did nothing about that, right? And the reason, I believe, why they did nothing about it is because, you know, as I told you earlier, they do not want to have to confront the big chemical companies in Washington, D.C., right? They'd rather keep their heads down, keep their jobs, have a quiet life. So they nevertheless have to go through this process of massaging data and so forth, which is troublesome for them. It takes them years to go through all these iterations of getting rid of this data, and they have all these committee meetings, and they have all these processes that they go through in order to do this. It's way easier for them is to have fraudulent testing, because then it never even crosses their threshold, right? So that's why they didn't solve the problem. And what if the information, if those tests, for example, were to be brought in-house to the EPA, then they would be subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. It would all be laid out. If they were doing it fraudulently, it would be very, very hard for them to conceal that.
So having it done commercially then blocks it from the public's eye.
Yeah, it hides it.
What is dioxin, and what role has the EPA played in keeping the public, in effect, exposed to dioxin?
Yeah. So dioxin is a substance that is a byproduct of many chemical reactions that involve chlorine and carbohydrates. So it's basically, when you add chlorine to chemical reactions, it is a byproduct that is stable. So it's one of the end products that if you run the reaction too fast or too far or too hot, you'll generate large amounts of this stuff. If you keep the conditions optimized for the production of what you want to make, then the amount of dioxin will be relatively little, but sometimes nevertheless can be very significant. So in the case of 2,4-5-T, for example, 2,4-5-T is one half of the herbicide Agent Orange. So the other half is 2,4-D. And those two chemicals were Agent Orange, and 2,4-5-T was very heavily contaminated, even under normal production processes, with dioxin. And so this is what led to the Vietnam veterans having all these health defects and the epidemic of birth defects in Vietnam and so forth. So this is a compound, and it's still a contaminant of pesticides today. So this is still a very relevant story. And for example, you know, if Monsanto goes bust, for example, people will start buying pesticides from China, from India, from Indonesia that we're pretty sure have very high levels of these compounds in them. So we will go back or to even a worse place than where we were at the time of the Vietnam War. So there's very high stakes here.
And the role of the EPA in not protecting the public from dioxin?
Yeah. So what happened was in 1970, Dow wrote to EPA and told them some or all of what they knew about the toxicity of these compounds. And so this is, you know, before Agent Orange. Agent Orange wasn't banned until probably until 1982 or so. So
this and both Dow and Monsanto produced Agent
Orange?
Yeah,
they did, yeah. So they were both producing it, and other companies, too, were producing it. So what happened in the chemical industry is that they had quite a deep understanding of what it was they were doing and what harm it had, for example. So there's a letter in the Poison Papers from 1964 in which Dow is in a sort of a panic because they're ramping up the production of Agent Orange and all their workers are getting sick. And they end up having a virtual mutiny at their plant. There's a report in there about all the procedures they took to protect their workers. You know, they put a doctor in the plant and then they got all these kind of cleaning procedures and then they end up building a wall around the production facility and stuff. It sounds totally nightmarish. And no doubt it was because the workers were getting sick and they were complaining about this. Anyway, so these companies knew a lot about their products. And they've always denied that they had that they knew anything about the human toxicity of these compounds. But actually, there's a letter from Dow, I mean, back and forth between Dow and a German chemical company. And the German chemical company tells them that dioxins are too dangerous even to research. And so they knew that it was human, you know, toxic to humans, really toxic. So, but EPA's role in all this is to basically sit on its hands, right? They have access to all this information, and there's still no regulations in the U.S. about how much dioxin is allowed in your food, for example. The only regulations on dioxins are about cleanups from Superfund sites, and they've finally published a draft preliminary report in 2010, and they had basically sat on the information about dioxins for 40 years at that point. So they have done nothing. And the loophole they have is that dioxins are not produced deliberately. So they're all byproducts. And so there are no laws about byproducts and unfortunate things as a consequence of the manufacture of industrial chemicals. So these dioxins are, you know, ubiquitous. Everybody has dioxins. Every person on the planet is contaminated with dioxins. Dioxins, there's no safe dose. That means we've all been poisoned, basically. So we all are suffering, you know, a whole multitude of immune system problems and muscle weakness and carcinogenic effects, for example, of dioxins are well documented in the peer-reviewed literature. But EPA still is effectively doing nothing.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Jonathan Latham about the chemical industry and the Environmental Protection Agency. Jonathan Latham is executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which co-published the Poison Papers, a massive trove of documents that have been obtained about the cozy relationship between state regulators and the chemical industry. And you can find a link to the Poison Papers on our website, againstthegrain.org. Let me ask you about permethrin, which is widely used as an insecticide, also used topically for afflictions like lice. It's labeled as having low toxicity. What's the backstory of permethrin?
So, you know, this is an interesting case because it's one of the examples that are most carefully documented in the Poison Papers. So, essentially, EPA, when the final approval of permethrin was in 1982, the EPA already had they received seven different studies based on originating from different companies that all wanted to manufacture this product. So all of those studies were flawed in one way or another. And the evaluators of – there's a report from one evaluator who says basically that we are exposing the public to a potential risk of basically 10% of the population getting cancer – from permethrin alone, if they're allowed to use it at this dose that we've recommended. And so this is a person who's gone back through all the evidence that EPA has accumulated about permethrin. And this cancer rate, you have to remember, is nevertheless based on what appear to be flawed and fraudulent applications, right? So they've been massaged even before they get to the EPA. But what the EPA, you know, what he's he believes that his colleagues have been doing is, for example, taking evidence and not showing it to external review boards. So the EPA has a system of sharing information. They have an external sort of vetting system. But what he believes is that EPA, his colleagues, have not been showing all the information to these external review boards, right? So the checks and balances are being invalidated by all this processing. So that's what I sometimes call administrative fixes. You know, if you can't find a scientific argument and you can't find a logical argument to ignore this data, you can always just give it to a committee who if they don't receive enough information, are basically going to give the thing a clean bill of health. So permethrin is this compound that not only has this very high suggestion from the papers of carcinogenicity, but also what the applicants detected was that permethrin has this effect of coagulating proteins. So the rats were becoming ill in a chronic toxicological way, as well as developing cancer. So this is interesting in part because coagulating proteins are behind many mental health issues like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. So you have this set of illnesses that are caused by these coagulating proteins that become more and more common currently. And permethrin is not acknowledged anywhere in the scientific literature, so far as I can see, of causing these kinds of illnesses. Yeah, this is a very clear outcome from the test that was submitted to the EPA. But it was ignored. So the studies into the long-term studies that are often done on rats and mice, they're called long-term chronic and carcinogenicity studies. That means they're supposed to study carcinogenicity, but at the same time, they're supposed to keep an eye out for chronic illnesses that may be developing that have nothing to do with cancer. And so here's a flat-out case in which there's perfectly clear evidence from the studies that these animals have a long-term health issue resulting from this pesticide. But it doesn't appear anywhere in EPA's final summary. So they've ignored it. They basically, it wasn't even mentioned from the start. So EPA is claiming to be looking for illnesses and health problems that in practice it is actually not. It's ignoring them.
So given these examples, how should the public regard chemicals that have been approved for use or labeled as, relatively safe? Is there any way for us to navigate any of this if we're not scientists? Should we just assume everything is toxic?
The problem, is a little more than what you say, because even scientists, unless they want to go and read the 20,000 documents or whatever, and they're welcome to do that, obviously. But unless you want to delve down into these documents, even the scientists who read the peer-reviewed literature, who read EPA's final reports and all the information that's publicly available, would not be able to know, because of fraudulent reporting and fraudulent submissions and so on and so forth, will not be able to know the toxicity of these compounds. There is no way for us to know, basically. So what I tell people is, I use, in my household, I use wood and glass and metal objects as much as possible. I reduce our exposure to all these compounds, and I treat them all as untested. Basically, I assume that they are untested. And you can, the second thing you can do, one can do, is go to the peer-reviewed literature. But the peer-reviewed literature is often quite a good indicator of what's going on. There are some compounds, for example, permethrin, there's very little information in the peer-reviewed literature about that compound. But if you go to the peer-reviewed literature, you'll find many compounds and very little is known about. Another sort of stumbling block of the peer-reviewed literature is some of it is published by companies with conflicts of interest. And I would ignore that information basically utterly, especially if it contradicts unconflicted research, or what you believe to be unconflicted research. The other problem is, if you go to the scientific literature, it's only relatively recently that scientists have started reporting their conflicts of interest. So historical data often will not report conflicts of interest at all. Interestingly, many of the key toxicology journals do not actually require reporting of conflicts of interest, right? And this is the place where you're probably going to want to go the most. And many of those, the journals are actually, I would say, pet journals of the chemical industry. So you have all these journals that there's basically a scandal going on at the moment. It's in a journal of occupational health in which one of the authors who set it up about 20 years ago because basically couldn't get any of his research published in the peer-reviewed literature because it was all controlled by the chemical industry, set up this journal. And this journal of occupational health has been, you know, supporting him and many other people who have concerns about toxic chemicals, allowing them to get their research published in a peer-reviewed way. Not very long ago, the editorial board was basically was bypassed by the publisher, who appointed an industry consultant as the chief editor, and they got rid of the old editor without asking the editorial board. And the editorial board has resigned, and I don't know what's going to happen next. But these are the stakes, right? Is that clearly the industry has confidence in these other toxicology journals. They don't feel they have to remove the editor of those journals. But in this case, where you know, these are holdouts, basically, from the chemical industry's point of view. And so essentially they've been targeted by a combination of the chemical industry and the publisher, right? The publisher is colluding with the chemical industry to shut down that journal from the point of view of independent research. So the whole thing is a minefield.
Scientist Jonathan Latham is my guest. He's executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. My name is Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what you're describing there about how the chemical industry has also penetrated academia, these scientific journals, reminds me of the way the tobacco industry also has functioned and the way that it bought off particular scientists and was able to have people on the payroll to help bolster up the notion that tobacco was not so harmful. And like the tobacco industry, there has now been the release of an enormous amount of documentation about, a lot of it through litigation, of the wrongdoings and collusion and cover-up of the chemical industry. And something similar is taking place with the poison papers. I wonder if you could just tell us about the origins of this collection.
We obtained just short of 3 tons of paperwork primarily from a woman called Carol Van Strom. Also, some came from someone called Eric Francis Coppolina. And so there was a couple other sort of more minor sources. What happened was that Carol Van Strom was writing articles for our website, and she was making strong claims, the Independent Science News. She was making strong claims about the EPA and its collusion with the chemical industry. And so I was saying to her, well, Carol, you can't put this on our website without supporting data. You know, I want to have PDF files of the minutes and the correspondence and so on and so forth. And eventually, after I asked her a bunch of times, you know, she's not computer savvy. She didn't know how to scan these documents. I wasn't even sure that she could actually find them in her collection. And so she basically said, you know, I'm just not bothered. I'm not going to publish anything. And she published it somewhere else. But I kept in mind her description of her documents that she claimed were in her barn and so forth. So eventually, I made some calls to find out who she was and whether it was really plausible that she had all this incriminating information about the EPA. And people said, yeah, quite likely she does. You know, she's been doing Freedom of Information Act requests. She's been doing interacting with lawyers, collecting their documents from court cases. She's had contacts with whistleblowers who have sent her stuff. So she has all this access to information, and indeed, that this was all true. So we raised $40,000, which is still a shoestring budget to do this kind of thing. And so we raised this money, and we got it scanned. And she, you know, her history is really interesting because she was essentially sprayed, airily sprayed. She lives in Oregon, in the backwoods of Oregon. She was airily sprayed by a helicopter that came through the valley, and her children became sick. Her animals became sick. The fish in the river died. All this stuff happened. And she didn't know whether that was really the cause or not, but it happened again. So she's like, this absolutely is to do with this compound. This turned out to be Agent Orange. And she did not, she didn't know that at the time, but she's embarked on this huge odyssey of trying to find out. And it mushrooms from Agent Orange and dioxins, which are the contaminants that, you know, probably were the cause of all these issues, into issues around PCBs and issues around pesticides and all this information that she acquires. And some of it's, you know, purely company information. There's all these minutes of meetings between all the different chemical companies about what to do about dioxins and stuff, all this really fascinating stuff. And but what's interesting about these documents in terms of the UCSF also is that, you know, hopefully journalists can use them. Hopefully lawyers can also use them. So there's this whole kind of culture of document holding among lawyers, for example. So they have, certain companies will have all these collections of documents that derive from previous court cases and discovery which has allowed them to bring this, extract this stuff from the companies. And then what happens is if you have a big enough collection of documents, then you can see how that you can build a case against the company, the chemical companies. And so what we're really hoping is that these documents will add very significantly to these collections of documents that are now available for lawyers especially, but also journalists. And we've seen in the court case against Monsanto around glyphosate the important role that these kinds of documents can play. And so we're hopeful that some people will start to get redress from the chemical industry, because the chemical industry has been incredibly effective at fending off claims from the public, from Vietnam vets, for example. You know, Vietnam vets were saved. Basically, Monsanto was saved from the Vietnam vets, largely by a whole bunch of studies that Monsanto did on the people who lived, on the people who worked in their own factories, who were exposed to dioxins, because they were manufacturing these compounds, right? They're manufacturing Agent Orange, so the exposures of those workers in the factories is really relevant. And there's a whole – the company's always maintained that humans are not injured by Agent Orange, apart from getting a rash. And so what the poison papers show, for example, is that the published peer-reviewed papers that are on the workers at Monsanto's factory that were exposed, there were three papers that were totally crucial to them fending off the claims of the Vietnam vets. Because these studies show that there's no harm from Agent Orange, right? Of no carcinogenic effect. It turns out those studies were fraudulent. Okay, so EPA sabotages its own investigation into those papers. That there is an admission in those papers, for example, from Monsanto's chief medical officer, that they basically put people into the control groups and took them out of the treatment groups in order to make the results come out the way they wanted. Mm-hmm. And then there's an admission in the papers too, for example, that essentially, you know, they went through this cancer disaster. And we're concerned about dioxins as a source of cancer. And so this is another admission that they actually knew internally that they had a problem with dioxins and cancer that has, you know, never come out before.
Let me end by turning things back to the EPA, because over the last 40-plus years, they've played a really central role in, as you argue, not protecting the public, but protecting the chemical industry. Since the election of Donald Trump, his appointment of Scott Pruitt, who has been removed, but the EPA is still trundling along, there has been a sense that the EPA is under attack by the Trump administration, and therefore activists and people on the left need to defend the Environmental Protection Agency. Given everything that you've said, now obviously a lot of that is around climate change and shutting down coal plants, but just sort of bracketing that for a moment, do you think that the EPA is an institution that needs to be defended and shored up How do you see it? And is it possible to reform it, or is it just too structurally compromised?
So, you know, just to preface this discussion, I do believe the government has a role in protecting the public. Right? It fundamentally is absolutely necessary to have an agency that does the job that the EPA is supposed to do. But you have to go back to the origins of the EPA. It was set up after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and it was set up by Richard Nixon. Okay, he is a very smart person. He understands his way around bureaucracy and so forth. He set up the EPA to be a buffer between the angry public and the chemical industry, which was under assault at that time. And that has always been EPA's role. So, but in order for it to fulfill that role, the chemical industry has to make a lot of noise about how they're being overregulated by the EPA, how they're being bullied by the EPA, how EPA is setting all these stringent rules and is stifling innovation and so forth, right? They have to sell the story, because if they didn't sell the story and they said, oh, yeah, don't worry, EPA's in our pocket anyways, right, then the game will be up, right? It doesn't function for them unless they make all this noise about how assertive the EPA is, right? So the problem is that for the most part, the environmental movement, but also Donald Trump, have fallen for this shadow play, right, this kabuki. And so what Donald Trump now is doing is saying, well, I'll sort it out for my friends in the chemical industry and the oil industry and so forth, right? But really, he's just a dupe who doesn't understand the game, right? The chemical industry is probably really mad with him because he's going to put all these people who are their own, you know, associated with them and kind of blown the game open. But the problem is that the environmental groups, instead of understanding that, you know, there are some exceptions, but instead of understanding that actually this is an opportunity for them, have then gone and said, well, we need to support the EPA. So I have, you know, well-meaning friends who work for environmental groups who think we should be supporting the EPA, when really what they should be doing is pushing the EPA harder than ever to basically achieve the reforms that they want. Because the EPA is, like I said, is totally not protecting the public. And I can cite many, many more examples than this of collusion and between the EPA in all kinds of different ways, you know, including climate change and so on and so forth. They're still colluding with the chemical industry, fracking, you name it. So what environmental groups have done is miss their opportunity to actually challenge the EPA in a much more fundamental way. And, you know, we have to get away, as environmentalists, we have to get away from tackling chemicals on a single compound at a time process. There's totally a structural problem here with the honesty and integrity of the EPA. But it was spiked from the beginning by Richard Nixon. And we probably don't have time to go into all this, but this is really important because Richard Nixon, for example, allowed the EPA to write the rules that it then enforced. Right. So EPA, basically, when Congress writes a new piece of legislation, they just give a very broad remit to EPA and say, just sort this, you know, sort this Superfund business, right? Sort the chemical testing business, whatever. So EPA gets to write the rules, and what they end up doing is writing loopholes into their own rules so that they never have to be troubled with prosecuting the chemical industry, because all they do is need to have a quick look around the table and go, well, we're never going to win this case, therefore we're not going to fight it, and therefore we don't have to prosecute. So you've got this game that's gone on since the inception of the EPA, in which this whole agency is a facade and is not intended to do its job and never was intended to do its job, but is now being protected primarily by environmental organizations who are the chief victims of this thing. The environmental movement has largely collapsed in many ways because we have an agency that pretends to be doing their job. If people understood there was no agency, it's not doing anything, then actually there would be a chance of reform. But you have to pinpoint the problem. And this is why we got our interest in the poison papers in the first place, right? It's because what I do most of the time is investigate GMOs. And I saw this collusion with the industry. Totally, you know, it's so obvious. When you understand the science well enough, it's so obvious. But there's no, you know, I don't have any proof that I can show to a journalist and say, look what they did, look what they did, because I have access to their internal decisions and so forth. So that's why we were interested in these documents, because they provide that fundamental proof that it's really hard to get from other industries like GMOs and other ways.
Jonathan Latham, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've been speaking with the executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which has co-published the Poison Papers. And you can find a link to the Poison Papers on our website, againstthegrain.org. Hundreds of thousands of documents about the collusion between state regulators, including the Environmental Protection Agency and the chemical industry. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.